This meeting is called to order. Where's my gavel? Boom. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make. Mr. Smith.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of this meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll begin with the Regs, Regulation Committee. Commissioner Friedkin, please call your committee to order.
Okay. We'll convene Regulations Committee. First order of business is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes. Do we have a motion for approval?
So moved.
Moved by Commissioner Bivens, second by Duggins. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, update on Parks and Wildlife progress and implementing the Parks and Wildlife Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things I want to mention to all of you. I want to remind you that on the 9th of April, we have the official groundbreaking for the new Game Warden Training Center there in Hamilton County, and so I hope all of you have that on your calendars. It's going to be a big day for us. Very proud of the cadet class that's going through that right now. I think once there were 55 cadets, we're now down to 50. So the survival of the fittest is working well there. And we are also taking applications for the next class, which will start in November. So those of you who know qualified applicants, make sure that they get their applications into us. I think they have until the 30th of April to do so. We're excited about that. Also, I think all of you are very familiar with the successful crab trap removal program we have out in the bays and estuaries on the coast. Since its inception, have removed about 25,000 of those ghost traps out in the bays and estuaries. Catches a lot of non-target and bycatch species. We have tremendous volunteer efforts that help support that. A lot of fishing guides, a lot of coastal enthusiasts work with our fisheries biologists and fisheries managers on the coast, and finished that up in May, and the coastal fisheries team did a great job on that program. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back over to you. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Carter. Committee item two, potential changes to the Migratory Game Bird Proclamation. Dave Morrison. Corey, please.
Clayton.
Got it. And Clayton. Hey, you don't look like Dave.
Mr. Chairman and commissioners, my name is Clayton Wolf. Yes, it's a surprise here. Up here with me is Dave Morrison.
Dear.
I'm here in a little different capacity this morning, other than big game issues. In our interim here, Clay Brewer, as the acting division director, has assigned a couple of us different projects to work on. One of mine is the regulations process for the wildlife division. So in addition to our resident species out here, recently have been immersed in our migratory regulations. I was asked to be part of this presentation to talk to you about the regulations process for migratory birds, because it is a bit more complex than we deal with on our resident species. And then, of course, Dave and Corey both will be here to provide the briefing items as well as the proposals and talk about the technical aspects. The management of migratory birds is an international effort, We have treaties with several other countries for the management of birds, and it's probably quite apparent that this is necessary for effective management, because these are shared resources. These migratory species can breed and winter in different states and in different countries, and so without a coordinated effort, manage of them would be futile. And so in the United States, the management of migratory birds is in accordance with federal law. Now, the states, such as Texas, have input into this process, but ultimately the Fish and Wildlife Service makes the final decision. And I do need to add that the states can adopt regulations that are more restrictive, but we cannot adopt regulations that are more liberal than the federal frameworks. And so what I'm going to attempt to do is take this process and display it to you, hopefully, so that there's there's some understanding. There are two time frames when we talk about migratory bird regulation proposals in the fish and wildlife process. There's the early season process, which deals with dove, teal, rail, gallinule, and then the late season framework, which is our ducks, geese, and cranes. Now, the one thing I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to reverse the order. We're going to talk about late season first. The reason we're going to talk about late season first is it's simply a briefing. We're not asking for any permission to publish any action. It's just kind of a preview. It's going to be similar to our November meeting when we present the statewide hunting and fishing proclamation to you. I'm also going to talk about several bodies that are involved in this decision making, or that are either advisory bodies or decision making bodies in this process. We have flyweight technical committees, and actually Dave Morrison and Corey Mason are on these technical committees. In fact, I learned just yesterday that Dave is also the consultant to the Flyweight Council. The Flyweight Council, of course, we're in the Central Flyway, and the Flyweight Council is made up of members from all 10 states. And Vernon Bevel, our small game and habitat assessment program director, is on this Flyway Council. And so the technical committee takes the technical information, and then through a consultant, in this case Dave Morrison, he takes that information to the Flyway Council, and the council deliberates these recommendations. And then the council actually has two consultants, and in fact Vernon Bevel is one of those consultants for the Central Flyway Council. And they make recommendations to the Service Regulations Committee. The Service Regulations Committee is the body that makes the decision within the Fish and Wildlife Service. Obviously, they still have to pass that up through the chain of command for proposal in the Federal Register and adoption. But we use the decision the Service Regulation Committee makes as kind of our start gun to say this is what we know is going to happen. And then, of course, this commission then makes decisions to adopt state rules that are consistent or more restrictive than the federal frameworks. So I'm going to try to display this to you on a timeline. You have a timeline there before you, and if you'll focus your attention there on the far left first. In January, the Service Regulation Committee gets together, and that's when they offer up the first preview of what they think the federal frameworks will look like. And once that takes place, then there are a couple of meetings that will take place between the technical committees and the flyway councils. They'll deliberate, they'll think about options, give some feedback, and then ultimately, when this is said and done, they'll give recommendations to the Service Regulations Committee. And if you'll note there on the timeline, the last item that I've shown is in late July. That's when the Service Regulations Committee makes that decision that is critical for us. That's a start gun for us to know what we would propose to go forward with. We've got a couple other items. If we look in the bottom side of the timeline, these are things in Texas going on, and we know that hunting season, the youth waterfowl season, begins in late October in most years, and so we've got to be cognizant of the fact that we've got to get to the register with proposals, and we also have publications we put together, our late season migratory hunting digest. And so we do have some deadlines there. Now, fortunately for us, if you'll notice, sandwiched right in the middle is August, and that's when we have a commission meeting. So this process, we are able to use something somewhat similar to our statewide hunting and fishing process, where we have a briefing, then we come back again in May, and then finally in August with an adoption. And that's what Dave is going to talk to you about this morning, is he's going to simply give you a briefing. We'll come back in May with permission to publish, and we'll have some more information on feedback from some of our constituents. And then in August, we'll ask this commission to adopt this. And I'll stop with that right now and cover the early season process later and turn it over to Dave to cover the briefing items.
Thank you, Clayton. My name is Dave Morrison. I am the Waterfowl Program Leader for the Wildlife Division. As Clayton mentioned, we will not be bringing any proposals at this time, but we will bring them in May. But we felt this would be a good time to talk to you about some of the changes that we think could be coming, some of the things that we're considering. First of all, the season date adjustments for the coming year. Another thing that we're going to discuss, hopefully in May, will be a return to the standard bag limit with species and sex restrictions. Also, we'll spend just a minute or two talking about an issue that we're dealing with respect to declines in white goose numbers. This calendar depicts what we're considering at this time. Typically what we do is we come before you in May and we will present to you season dates based on a liberal package. But that liberal package, we won't know for certain until July whether or not how we're going to deal with that, because we've got to wait on the biological information. What we'll do, we'll come to you with season dates, are basically a calendar adjustment from last year. That's what we've done in the past. This year will be no different. But the calendar adjustment this year is a little bit different, simply because the framework allows for 74 days and the ending date of January 31st. what you see before you, January 31st, is the last Sunday in January, but we're going to consider coming forward with a proposal that would end on January 24th. There's a couple of reasons for this. One is biological. There's a lot of us that believe that running this season that late into January is not necessarily good for the resource. And Texas has not had a season, a duck season, that ran till January 31st since 1930. There's a second reason for that. This commission has shown some concern in the past with respect to the deer and the waterfowl youth hunts occurring on the same weekend. If we consider a season similar to this, then the deer, youth, and waterfowl season would not occur on the same weekend. But I should warn you that there's going to be some people that are going to look at this and say, we really want to go to the end of the framework. Yeah. So that's the reason why this calendar adjustment is going to be a little bit different than in past years. One of the big changes is going to be changing the duck bag limit. We're almost certain that we may be coming out of the hunter's choice and going back to return to the standard bag limit with species and sex restrictions. Texas has been involved in the hunter's choice experiment for the last 3 years, and the bag limit that we've had during that time is shown on your screen. Many of you may remember that in the early 2000s, as recently as 2005 season, we had partially closed or season within season, even closed seasons on certain species that may not be able to meet the harvest that is required under certain management plans. As a result, the Fish and Wildlife Service imposed more restrictive seasons. For example, pintails had a season within season in 2005 of a 39-day season. Central Flyway came up with an alternative to that, the alternative being Hunter's Choice, an attempt to use the aggregate bag. That's the important piece of Hunter's Choice, the one mallard hen or one pintail or one canvas or one mottled duck, using those species to buffer against each other and hopefully have a harvest that was at least similar to a season within season, but certainly less than a full-length season. Last year was the end of that study. The information is going to be analyzed this coming year. At the next regulatory cycle, we will present the results of that study to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and at that time, we'll determine if Hunter's Choice is an alternative to season within seasons. Hunter's Choice is not completely dead for this year, but the fate of Hunter's Choice will not be known until the July meeting, the July SRC meeting. If Hunter's Choice is not provided as an option, then we would return to the conventional bag limit of 6 ducks per day with the various species and sex restrictions. I should caution, though, that anytime you have a conventional bag, there is always the possibility of a season within season. For example, if canvasback numbers come in and said that we can only have a 39-day season, those dates that are darkened would be when the canvasback season would be closed. And canvasback can only be part of your daily bag limit for the last 39 days. So it's a little bit trickier when you're dealing with conventional bags. Another thing I want to talk to you is what we have been in discussions among staff about concerns that we have with respect to white goose numbers. White goose numbers continue to be a continental concern, and their numbers are still at or above and are considered overabundant. Habitat destruction is continuing in the Arctic breeding grounds. Not only are snow goose suffering from this overabundance problem, but those other Arctic nesters that share this breeding ground are also having some problems. This slide depicts what the population of one breeding colony at Carrick Lake near Queen Maud Gulf has done from 1993 to 2007. It shows almost exponential growth. Even though continental populations of white geese are at or near record levels, the numbers in Texas have seen pretty good decline since the advent of more liberal hunting regulations. During the course of the coming year, we're going to look at various aspects of the white goose season structure, whether it be the bag limit, whether it be the season length, even the conservation order. Because right now, we don't know what the best approach is. But we're going to talk among staff. We're going to try to get our hunters involved. And before we make any substantial changes in the goose regulations, we're going to talk to these people and try to come, not this year, but next year, with something to address this decline in white goose numbers in Texas. With that, I'll end it and take any questions you may have.
So at this point, we don't know that that's necessarily hunting related.
The reasons for the decline are really varied. I mean, you look at what's going on in Arkansas and Kansas. Kansas had 400,000 birds this year. Typically, Texas would winter in from 80 to 90% of the white geese in the central flyway. Now we're down to about 41%. But continental populations have not declined. It's just this Texas portion that, for some reason, birds aren't getting to Texas, and we're trying to figure out a way, how do we at least keep those birds here in Texas longer and provide maximum opportunity. We're not suggesting that we're trying to back away from harvest simply because there continues to be a continental population. We're just looking at how do we restructure this thing to provide the best possible opportunities.
But is the decline Texas only, or is it within the entire central flyway?
Basically within Texas.
Anyway. Can you give us some reasons or some thoughts, or about either anecdotal or scientific?
Well, there's a lot of things. If you see that timeline there, that when we went to a more liberalized season in 1999, there was no other state in the United States better prepared to implement the light goose conservation order and liberalized backs, because we had goose hunters. We had people who knew what they were doing, they had the gear, and we had the geese. And we dropped the hammer on them. White geese are very adaptable. Guess what? They're going to find other places to go. If I'm going to get shot here, I'm going to go someplace else. And there's some of that going on. You look at what's going on up and down the flyway. There's lots of groceries north of Texas. So they stop off in Kansas and say, hey, look, I got all this corn, I got water. Why do I want to fly that extra 800-900 miles and get shot? I'm not trying to oversimplify this, but that. They are very adaptable species.
Right.
You see stuff going on even in the Arctic where they're changing their historical migration patterns due to pressure, finding food sources over here. Okay, I'm going to go over here. You take a look at the Mississippi Flyway. Mississippi Flyway has seen huge increases in their midwinter index. So Texas is the one that has really taken it on the chin, particularly when you consider that continental populations are very high. They're still at near record levels. They're just not getting here. When you look at Texas, at one time wintered 90% of the white geese in the state of Texas, compared to all the other central flyway states.
Oh, they were literally all coming south.
Literally all. Now we've got about 40% of the central flyway.
Are the other states doing as much as we are relative to, as you said, dropping the hammer on them and this 20-bag limit and those kind of things? Were they doing that much? Or not?
Well, I'll use Kansas again as an example. They had 350,000 to 400,000 birds in their state. They killed 15,000. They're not putting pressure on their birds like we do. We have a midwinter estimate of around 350,000 to 400,000 last year before last, and we shot about 250,000 birds. Now, that's not a direct relationship, I understand. That's just an indices compared to population estimates. But the decline, you can see the decline of what's going on. Now, understand that the intent was to cause birds to go down. That was the intent of the expanded and liberal seasons. But the continental population has not gone down. It's simply a Texas problem.
So then once they go back north, your counts up there, let's go back. I guess that's what you were showing in the previous slide.
Yes, sir.
Let's go back to the previous slide.
Okay, this is one breeding population, only in a localized area.
I know, in one location. But your snow geese dropped.
Yes, sir.
Fairly dramatically. And your Ross geese went up.
If I could point out that snow goose drop.
Through this chart here.
Okay. That snow goose drop, yes, there was a decline. But a lot of the stuff, you got to understand what's going on. That particular year, we had a very late ice out. And typically when you have a late ice out, your breeding numbers aren't there because they say, okay, we're not going to breed. They'll go someplace else, and only the really strong breeders will stay there. So some of these drops are tied to timing of nest initiation.
So what is, if we're the only state that's really having an impact through late season harvest, are we able to try to work with surrounding states to ask them to implement the same procedures? Because if they're just going to move elsewhere, then this is not having the desired effect.
Well, I think that it's not so much late season harvest as it is. Well, let me just preface it this way. We do not want to back off on harvest. What we want to do is keep birds in Texas. All right. There's a couple of things you could do that. You could reduce hunting pressure on a given day. Now, to reduce hunting pressure requires some pretty drastic steps to get people out of the field so these birds hang around. The longer these birds hang around, the more likely they are to say, hey, this is a pretty good place. We're going to stay here. We go back north. We're going to bring our kids back down here. And that's how you keep this number staying in Texas. So one way to address it is a daily pressure. You can look at season length. I'm not sure what season length will do simply because by the time the conservation order starts, those birds are already headed north. We're going to investigate all these during the course of the coming year and try to come up with the best answer that we can.
Yeah, Carter and I were just talking about the rice production being down. Is that
I do have a presentation. Yes, sir. We do have a presentation. I got a whole presentation. Just so you're aware, we had our flyway count, our flyway technical committee in Corpus back in March. We had two of the world's leading experts on snow goose research at our flyway meeting. We went ahead and had a public seminar. So those people come down. Rocky Rockwell talked about habitat destruction. Ray Osaskas talked about population. And I showed them what's going on in Texas. And so it was a good opportunity to float some of these things out there so people were aware. Needless to say that I have got lots of emails on this subject. But we are going to look at it because there's a lot of different ways to go. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to implement something that is destined to fail. Because they say, well, you guys didn't do anything. So we want to take a very careful look at this before we come to you guys with any proposals that will make substantial changes to the light goose hunting seasons.
Other late season questions? I've got one just in terms of process. So we have a gap here to May. So we won't really have a better sense of where we might be going with late season.
Honestly, no, sir.
In May.
Okay. No, sir. We will, what, in May... We may have some better ideas what habitat conditions look like because they will start doing their breeding surveys and their pond counts. The commission meeting, I'm not sure, is in late May, that we may have some preliminary information coming out of the breeding grounds what ponds look like. And we may be able to narrow it down. Yeah, we're pretty, 90% sure that we're going to have a liberal season. With respect to bag limits, we thought Hunter Choice was dead, honestly. But some discussions that occurred at the National Flyway Council and at the North American last week kind of indicate, well, service, because there was so much support in a survey that the Central Flyway did, a human dimension survey, tremendous amount of support for the Hunter's Choice that the service, maybe we're not going to say it's completely dead just yet. But I think that a lot of stars have to align to give us that season again.
Okay.
Good.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd like to call up Corey Mason. Once again, for the record, I'm Clayton Wolf, and now I'd like to talk about the early season proposals. Up here with me is Corey Mason. He's our Webless Migratory Program Leader, and he will cover all the proposals and the technical aspects of this presentation. Once again, I'm going to show you this timeline here, and the timeline is a bit different. And I'd also like to add that I do have copies of these timeline slides and also one that's a little bit more, has more detail on it that I've given to Carol Hemby. So anybody that's interested in a hard copy of these that they want to take with them, because some of this information.
The whole presentation?
We can give you the whole presentation, but she has just three slides right now.
I'd like to get the whole thing.
Yes, sir, we can do that. On this process, Some of the same items, same meetings begin. We have the Service Regulations Committee. It's the same committee meeting in January. And then our technical committees relative to the early season regulations take place in February and March. And as you might, you just heard Dave say, the Flyway Council met last week at the North American and Vernon Bevel and his counterparts got a little bit better information about what we might anticipate for the future. The difference on the early season process is that the decision that the Service Regulations Committee makes is made in late June this year. So it's not in July, it's bumped up. And in Texas, we know that dove season begins around the 1st of September. So what we're not afforded in Texas at this time is the opportunity for an August adoption, for a look at this in August. So because of the cycle that the feds have for this early season process, things are pushed up a bit. We also typically, late June is the very latest that we would do our final edits on our outdoor annual, and we like to get our early season regulations in our outdoor annual. So you can see we're looking at a real tight deadline there. From when the Service Regulation Committee meets to getting something in print for our hunters to see. And, of course, we have March and May commission meetings. And so Corey this morning is going to give you a presentation on proposals, and we will come back in May. However, the Service Regulations Committee won't meet till June. And so when we come back in May, it'll be another briefing. We may have some more refined information, maybe higher probabilities about what is going to occur. But the significant difference is that state statutes and Texas regulations, Texas Administrative Code regulations, allow for the executive director to adopt these regulations because of this unique circumstance with migratory bird regulations. Mr. Smith, of course, has to do that in consultation with the chairman. So in the ideal world, when we give the briefing, the final briefing in May, there won't be any changes. It'll be pretty much rubber stamped, and Mr. Smith will consult with the chairman and we'll go along. But there is a possibility that there could be changes and that consultation would have to take place. And hopefully, if we have all our information, we have discussed those other potentials before you. So with that, I will turn it over to Corey to present the early season proposals.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Corey Mason, Webless Migratory Game Bird Program Leader, and I'm going to address early season proposals. The first proposal we'd like to bring to you relates to waterfowl-related. It's related to our September till season. Basically, Fish and Wildlife Service has the option to bring forward three packages, the first being a 16-day season, and the second being a 9-day season. The third is the potential always of a closed season. Now, these season packages are based on breeding population numbers, so based on triggers, certain triggers. So if a breeding population number is above 4.7 million results in a 16-day season, 3.2 to 4.7 million, it's a 9-day season. And if it falls below that 3.2 million trigger, there's always the option out there. It's not likely, but a closed season. It's been commission policy if there's a 16-day season that we run it the last 2 weeks of September with the last 3 weekends. And if it's a 9-day season, we run it the last full week with 2 weekends. And just to kind of illustrate that here, this is the option, what a 9-day option would look like, that last week with 2 weekends. And the 16-day option is those two full weeks and 3 weekends. Now, once again, this is not something that we will not know definitively where we stand until after these breeding population estimates have been delivered from the service, and we won't know until that SRC meeting that Clayton mentioned in June. Now, related to other species, a proposal related to rail, gallinule, snipe, and woodcock. These are basically no changes from last year, just calendar date adjustments. You'll notice that rail and gallinule seasons we've attempted to run concurrently with the early September season. Once again, we don't know exactly where that's going to fall yet. There's possibly some latitude there to adjust accordingly so that we're running it concurrently with those early season hunts. But you'll see September 12th through the 27th, which once again is just a calendar adjustment. Related to woodcock, you see the dates are the same from last year to this year. The reason for that being is we're given a 45-day season structure from the service to hunt for woodcock season, January 31st being the last day possible for us to hunt, and so we just go from January 31st backwards in the calendar 45 days, which gives us December the 18th date. No bag differences related to these species. We have several dove-related changes related this year that we'd like to present today. First, I'd like to present these changes and the proposals for proposals to take to the Texas Register. And then secondly, I'd like to present the rationale related to the derivation of these proposals. The first being a 70-day season and 15 bird bags statewide. The second being moving the South Zone opening to the Friday nearest September the 20th, but no earlier than the 17th. And lastly, adjusting the special white-winged dove area boundary specifically related to Jim Hogg and Stark counties. Now, some of you may be aware with adaptive harvest management, it's been a concept related to the derivation of season structures for ducks for about the last decade. Over the last several years, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Mourning Dove Task Force, and technical committees have been working on trying to come up, devise an adaptive harvest management for mourning dove. Technical committees approved this in 2008 with anticipated implementation in the 2009 regulation structure. Now, once again, this will not be implemented or accepted by the service until the June meeting. AHM uses parameters such as monitoring data, population data, and harvest to derive season structures. Now, three season structures were adopted or derived, and these all being based on a 70-day season. The first being a liberal at 22 birds, the second being a moderate at 15, and the third being a restrictive at 8. Now, the service has evaluated all the parameters associated with the life requisites of mourning dove and the monitoring data, population data, and harvest, and determined that the central management unit, which includes Texas, would fall in the moderate package for the next 3 years. Now, we recently had a Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee conference call, and we ran this through the committee, and most were in favor of it. We did have a notable minority that expressed some concerns, and I would like to address those concerns. Those concerns were specifically related to the additional time spent in the field related to trying to achieve this three extra bird in the bag harvest. So going from 12 to 15 would result in a little bit more time spent in the field to get those three birds. So the concerns were related to impact on harvest within those fields, so time spent in the field. Current existing federal frameworks related to the South Zone opening allow us to not open earlier than September the 20th. Commission policy is also that we do not, has been in the past, that we do not open until the Friday after September the 20th, unless the 20th falls on a Saturday. So under this current scenario here, you can see that this year, the 20th falls on a Sunday, which would mean this year that the season would open on Friday the 25th. Well, this year we are proposing that the South Zone open on the Friday nearest September the 20th, but not earlier than the 18th. You can see here graphically that this would basically open, you know, a week earlier. And next year, on the calendar adjustment for next year, the 20th falls on a Monday. So next year we are proposing that we would open on the 17th. We also ran this through the Migratory Advisory Committee, and all were in favor of this.
So that would be the reason of the change, just because of the calendar days?
Yes, ma'am. Because for the last several years, we've been opening about an average of 3 days later than the federal frameworks allowed. So it would just enable us to take full advantage of those opportunities that are there, specifically related to the South Zone.
Additional weekend space.
Exactly.
You see any issues population-wise or migration-wise? And then, I mean, if you do this, adding a few days ahead of time, I mean, relative to the norm?
No, sir, not at all.
Corey, you might mention just the magic of the 17th and that threshold and why you wouldn't want to go any earlier.
Sure. Based on some previous nesting studies that have been done in the southern part of Texas, basically looking at earlier nesting doves, basically related to the opportunity of leaving orphan doves in the nest if the adults are harvested. And so that's the rationale of not going any earlier in the season than that. But based on past history, it showed that less than 11% had been hatched after September the 1st, with the majority of those being hatched the first 2 weeks of that 11%. So after that second week, basically, we're leaving very few orphan young in the nest, so available for harvest. These are the proposed season dates and bags for all zones. You'll notice here that this is a 70-day season statewide and 15-bird bag. A couple of things to pay particular attention to. In the north zone, you'll see that this year there's a proposal of a late-season split. This is run concurrently with the central zone. And once again, in the south zone there, you'll see that the proposed opening date of September the 18th versus the 25th this year.
Is there any reason why, or when are we going to discuss whether or not we should adjust or try to adjust those dates? Is this the right time?
Sure, whenever you want to talk about it.
Well, I've had a number of people contact me and express an interest in reducing the proposed, the days in the proposed second season and not cutting off so many days in October. What are your thoughts in general?
Okay. Well, if you let me back up here real quick just to show it here so everybody can see what we're looking at here.
Excuse me, but which zone are you referring to?
North zone.
Okay. On this, what's proposed here in front of you is this is removing basically 5 days in October. Some of the earlier stuff that was on the website had about 2.5 weeks of October being removed. So this is different than what you're looking at there.
The original proposal was ending on October 11th.
Yeah, that's what I'm correct. Sorry, I was looking at the notebook instead.
And this is adjusted on the slide.
Yes, right. This is what we're proposing right here.
Right. See, Rob, we knew you were going to ask that question. So glad we're quick, Tom.
You're very quick.
You're keeping us all on our toes.
Yeah.
Is it, does that answer your question?
On the north zone, on the south zone, would the January 17th date be fixed, or can we, for future years, try to have the concept that we ended on the Sunday preceding MLK Day?
We always have the option to adjust these days.
I think it would be good to have that as the mindset, that we're going to try to end that second season in the South Zone on the Sunday preceding MLK Day rather than fixing it on the date just for future
MLK
years.
Day is always on Monday?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. What's your reason?
I just think people can follow it and plan accordingly if we try to always end it on that Sunday as opposed to picking the date if we have to adjust the days on the at the end of the first season. To make that work, I just think it's a more user-friendly format to know in advance that it's always going to end on that Sunday of that weekend.
So effectively increasing opportunity because they know of it and can plan
exactly.
a traditional it's event a, around it.
The only issue then goes to the start of the late season. If it's always going to end on the Sunday before MLK, then it wouldn't necessarily always be able to open on the 26th.
No, you could leave that. You just adjust the end date of the first season.
So you would take days off of the first season if you needed.
That's what I would propose.
Because there would be a 7-day
up to
range.
Yeah.
Calendar shift.
Right.
Just
yeah.
Maximum 7-day change in the total
right.
number of days in that season.
We have an additional item that that I'm going to present here in just a little bit that we would like to hold some public briefing on events on and public hearings on, and that's certainly something that we could present to the public
yeah,
and get them input on.
Yeah, because take a look at it.
See how people respond.
Mm-hmm. But just for clarification, do we have any other limiting factors or just the 7-day? It would have to be 70-day. It would have to come out of. We'd have to adjust it, right?
The two limiting factors are the earliest start date.
Okay.
We do have an ending date at the back end of January, and then 70-day season. So we have 70 days to put in between those two parameters somewhere there. Now, if we choose to take them from November or December and put them somewhere else, that's all acceptable.
So on
the
most drastic shift that you're talking about of the 7-day shortened 26th to Sunday before second South Zone season, take as an example. We would go add those dates potentially to the early side, but we wouldn't start earlier than September 17th, so potentially it would go beyond November 3rd. I mean, that would be an appropriate adjustment.
That would be an
option, right?
That would be an option. It's certainly something we could take forward to the hearing and get public input on.
Let's do that.
I have another question, and if this isn't the appropriate time to discuss this, then I'll certainly refer it for later, but. You mentioned the parameters, the federal parameters that we have to work within. The September 1st start date in the North Zone has been a regulation that has been set in stone due to a treaty that we are in with Canada. Now, the bird populations in the Northern Panhandle are much more bountiful in August, early to mid-August, than they are in, say, late September. What process would we have to go through to petition Fish and Wildlife to move that September 1st start date to August 15th?
Some of that would begin related on the biological end. It would first likely have to relate from some nesting studies, because you run, if you move too early back into the season, in the calendar season, you start running the risk of affecting breeding and individuals that have young in the nest.
Right, as was referenced in the.
And so that would be the first thing that would have to be addressed. And then from there, since September 1st is the start date within the whole central management unit, so there are 14 states affected there. It would be a fairly lengthy process, but it would have to first start on the biological end to see if it would even be biologically feasible before regulations would even come into play.
So we see, you want to take on the Canadian treaty, 14 states, the feds. You're a tough guy, Mark.
I've never said it'd be easy.
By the next regulatory cycle.
Yeah, I think we'll all be dead. But yeah, by the next regulatory.
I'm confident in you, Mark.
Well, so is this something we want to explore, at least through conversations with
the
council?
I would like to just look into it, just to pursue the at least the biological aspects of it.
Corey, do we have any existing data on nesting up in the panhandle that our biologists have done that we might be able to share with the commission just to provide a little background in terms of what we have now?
I would have to look. I can't really speak to that, but I'll certainly look and provide if it's available. I'll certainly provide.
Yeah, I think that would be a good start just to get some quick data if possible to know whether it's something that's biologically sound and feasible and whether we should investigate a little bit further or not.
I mean, if it's not biologically feasible, then that would be the end of the issue.
Right. But your impression is that it is. Let's look at it. Good.
Okay. I have one more question.
I was just going to ask if when you have your hearings, that you also consider the same information for the beginning of the southstone season in terms of the immature birds and the small birds, that if we're going to give something up, it seems to me that would at least be appropriate to look at it to see what kind of impact that would have on the bird population.
Okay, and just can we get that information just whatever information we gather before, we'll get it disseminated before a meeting so we don't have to bring it up as a subject necessarily.
Sure, I think we can get that in the next couple of weeks, can't we, Court, in terms of assimilating that, and we'll distribute it to the commission.
Great, thanks.
Yep. Am I right that we're going to have, you're going to have scoping meetings for the south zone? What are you going to do for the north zone or just the south zone?
What we are relating our south zone scoping briefing hearings to, basically looking for some public input, is related to some potential boundary shifts, not necessarily related to these opening dates, although it would be something that would be mentioned, but it was specifically related to these zone options that I'll be mentioning here in just a minute.
Will there be north zone scoping meetings on the late season?
I think I can answer that. Hopefully, to clarify we are going to have some meetings soon about this south zone shift that we are suggesting be a proposal, and in a moment, Corey is going to discuss a couple of other items that we plan to scope over the next year, and that would include where those extra days fall in the north zone, and we could also include the south zone as well, and do that and talk about start dates, end dates, and all of these things that fall within the framework. But because we thought those were significant shifts for our hunters, and we didn't want to cause any confusion, we suggested that we give a year to scope those items and make sure we get some good data from our users out there, and then come to you in the next cycle with proposed changes.
I'm still not clear. Are you talking about having any meetings between now and our May commission meeting to take public comment on the North Zone second hunt date, late season hunt dates?
We had not anticipated that. We can, if you suggest. The South, the way we classify these in the South Zone, we've already got a lot of feedback, and this would basically just kind of finalize our decision in the North Zone. We've done some discussions among staff. And talked about overlaying the pheasant season with some days. However, there are concerns that because there's been a long tradition of hunting most of October, we wanted to we want to make sure that we proceed carefully, that we don't negatively impact some folks. But we surely could go forward with some scoping meetings in the North Zone if that's the desire of this commission, and have those results by May.
I'd like to suggest we try to have at least one to discuss the late season dates.
Okay.
Around the dates that you suggested before. Around the holiday. Around MLK.
Yeah, what are you looking for?
No, that's north. That's south. Yeah, I'm talking about.
You're talking north.
Basically, it's involving the October.
Yeah, I got you.
The absence of hunting opportunity in October, but due to the size of the north zone, we're going to have more than one meeting. Because you're going all the way from
one west,
across
one east
Texas. And so input. Granted, we can only have one set of parameters, depends on zone, but, you know, Amarillo guys can't get to, to attend the meeting. So I think it's only fair to try to be geographically sensitive on.
And I would say over the last year I've learned that our web comments are pretty useful in getting a large volume of information, and we can surely work with our partners in the press to get some press releases and put a survey instrument up on our web, and also and get a large volume of input from folks that can't attend these scoping meetings.
Good idea.
I think it's a real good idea on all issues to offer that opportunity.
I guess the question is whether we can impact this cycle, you know.
Yeah.
And it seems seems challenging to be able to get out and scope it properly.
Right. If we can't, then I think the dates that are proposed seem okay.
I think that was our perspective on this, that we had some changes that we were looking at, and we thought it might be helpful to take what we have on the table now, scope those well between now and May, get solid feedback on that. At those meetings, we typically have other issues that come up, like y'all are suggesting, and so we could fold those into the end of the future conversation along with these, and then really scope those in a very detailed, methodical process to bring back for the next regulation cycle. So we can do it however y'all would like for us to proceed on it, but I just wanted to make sure y'all were sort of apprised of what was going through our minds as we were thinking through these changes.
Well, I got a lot of feedback from the October 11th cutoff date.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would imagine.
And we've addressed that.
And so having this change in place, that's already addressed all the negative input that I've got, but I just think the process is a good process.
Okay.
So I think we proceed as you suggested, but try to get some, you know, early indicators of how people feel about
moving the dates and taking a look at those, both in the north zone and the south zone. And so we'll factor that into our calculus and planning for the next regulation cycle and start scoping those, but we won't be bringing any proposed changes tomorrow for your consideration, and certainly not for recommendation in May. Okay. So, Corey, it's nice and clear on that. Okay.
Yes. Good.
Do you have another question? No? Okay.
I wonder, are you looking at having the scoping meeting in the South Zone?
We don't have a date set yet, but we do have something that will affect the Heber Mill area, so that was one of the locations that we were looking at. But within the next month, you know, ish to 2 months, something like that. So very likely.
Corey and Clayton, can we address this issue, though, of even between now and May, of having multiple public hearings in the North Zone so that we have good coverage? Do we have the possibility to have a couple of meetings as opposed to just one, or we plan on that?
We can do that, yes.
But just
for clarification purposes, my understanding is we're really looking at proposing what you have on the screen, but
that's
we
right.
would use those meetings to help us formulate where we go for the next cycle?
Correct.
Okay, that's
what
I understand.
Yeah.
You know, with what we've got. But,
yeah. We can do that.
Okay. And now addressing special white-winged dove area. Really no changes here aside from the opening date there, September the 18th once again. The early 2 days, the September 5th and 6th, 12th and 13th, for those early 4 days that we have there, the Saturday-Sunday hunts, those are half-day hunts from noon to sunset. The aggregate bag limit of 12 with a morning dove restriction of up to 4 and white tip of 2. Now, the white tip restriction is not unique to the special white-winged dove area. That's a statewide restriction. And then the general season picking up September the 18th with a 15-bird aggregate bag running through January 13th. Now, you'll notice the south zone is January the 17th closing date, and this is the 13th. The reason for the 4-day difference being those early 4 days there in September, those count towards the 70-day season package. So. The service is currently reviewing a proposal related to the adjustment of the special white-winged dove area boundary. And these, as you can see here, this relates to particularly Jim Hogg and Starr counties. Now, point your reference here in the upper left corner. You'll see Laredo, and then there in the center of the screen, you'll see Hebronville. And coming south out of Hebronville, that's FM 1017, if you're familiar with that area. Now, the proposal is to remove these portions from the special white-winged dove area and they would just simply fall into the south zone. So the dates and bag would be concurrent with the south zone. So there's no opportunity loss. It's just moving them to a more appropriate area, to more mourning dove habitat versus white-winged dove habitat. Now, these areas are not as productive or high-quality white-winged dove habitat as the remainder of the white-winged dove areas, and they don't have as much production of small grains. So that's the reason for this move. Now, I'd like to also mention that the Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee was supported this proposal.
Has this been something coming? Help me, walk sure. me through the process. On
it's been something that we've been asked to evaluate from landowners in the area.
Okay.
For several years. We've
Good.
Been asking for input. Field staff evaluate the quality of the habitat and concur that it's more representative of mourning dove habitat than white-winged dove habitat.
Good. So we're responding to the landowners in that area?
Yes, sir.
And, okay.
So in summary, proposed changes for the 09-10 season are the adoption of an AHM season structure that results in a 70-day and 15-bird package statewide, moving the south zone opener to the Friday nearest September the 20th, but not earlier than the 17th, and adjusting the special white-winged dove area boundary. Now, we have a couple of items that we'd like to take this next year to evaluate and get some public input on before attempting to move forward with. Now, these are specifically related to the early 4 days in the special white-winged dove area and the placement of the north zone days. Now, currently, we run the 4 early days in the special white-winged dove area on the Saturday, Sunday of the first 2 weekends of September, which you see here. Recently, we had a recommendation from our Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee to consider moving these days to the Friday-Saturday instead of the Saturday-Sunday. Now, the committee brought this forward believing that the Friday-Saturday would better serve those hunters that are traveling so that they can travel on Friday mornings and hunt Friday afternoon, Saturday afternoon, and use Sunday as a travel day. After them having some initial discussions amongst the committee and considering the Labor Day holiday, they came to us with kind of a revised recommendation that looks like this in front of you, which their recommendation was the first Saturday, Sunday, take advantage of that Labor Day weekend, and then the second weekend being potentially a Friday, Saturday, to once again use Sunday as a travel day. Now, after some internal discussion between wildlife and law enforcement divisions, we have some concerns, a little bit about confusion this could lead to, having one Saturday-Sunday hunt and the next weekend being Friday-Saturday hunt. So we'd just like to take this next year to evaluate this, get some input in it, and just think about it a little bit more before we try to move forward with this. And the second is the placement of the north zone dates that we've had previous conversations about here. This year we're proposing to run run the season concurrent with the central zone, the opening of September 1st through October 25th, and December 26th through January the 9th. We'd like to take this next year to just discuss with public meetings, evaluate field staff after we just see how things are going, to get public input on the perception of this late season, if we'd like to move dates around more in December or less in October, just to get input on it.
Your advisory group was fine with it running concurrently?
Yes, sir.
I would assume. Have we done that in the past? I can't remember.
Well, last year we had a 60-day season in the north zone,
right.
So we just ran it from September the 1st through the end of October. Now with the additional 10 days,
right.
we ran for the option of having that late season split because we've had some interest in that. We've had several folks approach us about that. So currently, what we're proposing this year is to run 55 days instead of 60 like we did in the past.
Nice.
So the majority of all of September, most of October, and then 15 days late to take advantage of some of those late opportunities.
I've done like the concurrent running central and north.
We do have it running concurrently this year.
Not this year, but have we done it in the past? What I couldn't.
I'm sorry, I didn't answer that.
Sorry.
In the past, we haven't because we had 60 days in the north and 70 in the central.
That's right.
So
that's
we didn't have the opportunity to run concurrently.
Okay.
Well, that concludes what I have for you. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Very brief. Thank you.
Thank you.
No further questions or discussion. I will authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item number 3, proposed changes to the alligator proclamation.
Good morning.
Morning.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Amos Cooper. I'm the assistant area leader for the Upper Coast Wetland Ecosystem Project. and I appreciate the opportunity today to bring the proposed reg changes for the alligator proclamation. Basically for us, this is a general housekeeping change for us. All alligators harvested in Texas must be tagged with a site high tag because of similarity of appearance of endangered crocodilians elsewhere in the world. CITES stands for the Convention of International Trade in Endangered Species. On public hunting lands, there are two types of CITES tags for alligators. The first is a commercial high tag at a cost of $120. The second is a not-for-sale tag, which is specifically for personal use. The proposed amendment would clarify the alligators taken on public hunting land and initially tagged with a not-for-sale tag must be tagged with a commercial high tag purchased from the department if the alligator is to be entered into commercial trade. And that's all I have. Are there any questions?
Questions?
Yeah,
straightforward.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item number four, deer breeder rule amendments. Mitch.
That's very straightforward.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood, and I'm the Whitetail Deer Program Leader. At our last meeting, Mr. Smith mentioned to you our plan to propose a slight change to the rules regarding the transfer of breeder deer. The current rule is specific as to whom or where one may transfer legally possessed breeder deer. Those people or places that where one may transfer those deer include another deer breeder. They include another person for nursing purposes. They include, one may transfer a breeder deer to an individual for liberation purposes. They can transfer deer to a place to receive medical attention. And finally, they can transfer deer to a DMP facility or a deer management permit facility. Well, recently, a deer breeder offered to donate a breeder buck to an education display facility, and the current regulation doesn't allow for such a transfer. The staff see no reason to exclude such a transfer. Therefore, we propose to amend the current rule to allow the holder of a valid deer breeder permit to transfer deer to the holder of a valid educational display permit as authorized by the department. Such a transfer would be final. In other words, the deer may not ever return to another breeder facility. To date, as of yesterday afternoon, we've received 17 comments on this item, 16 of which support the proposal. The one in opposition really was opposed to the practice of deer breeding in general, and so I'm not sure that's really relevant to this particular proposal. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Am I right that on page 77 of the notebook is the in highlighted or bold are the proposed changes?
I have that page.
77?
Page 77.
Number 7?
Number 7 and number
3.
3, yes. And my questions were, what is meant by a valid educational display or zoological permit? Does that mean one issued by the state? And then second question is, haven't we left out zoological permit from 3 because it's up in 7?
Ann, maybe Ann can help us. So I'll do the lookout with the leader.
Good morning, I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. Actually, it's in both. What happened was there were two provisions. One has to do with the person to whom a breeder deer can be transferred when a permit terminates for whatever reason. The other one just has to do with just a general transfer by somebody who continues to hold a permit. What happened was apparently already for the provisions involving transfer when someone no longer has a permit. It already said zoological. So if you'll notice that
in
65.612 already lists as item 2 a zoological permit. So when we went back to fix this, we noticed that we also probably needed to put zoological permit up there in 6510 or 610 to make those consistent. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but my first question is, what is meant by a valid educational display or zoological permit?
There's a provision of the Parks and Wildlife Code that addresses both of those permits. I might have to get someone up here to talk about all the things that somebody can do with those permits. The educational display permit, I think that's pretty, that one's a little bit more self-explanatory.
But who issues the permit?
Parks and Wildlife Department.
Well, then shouldn't we say the holder of a educational display or zoological permit issued by Parks and Wildlife? I mean, valid sort of a...
We can do that. I mean, we can definitely make that change. Only Parks and Wildlife is authorized to issue those permits.
For clarification, I think it should say that instead of valid, which could mean valid in subjective terms. Somebody else may, what's a valid, somebody else may be.
Well, we get to decide what's valid. So, but we're more than happy to make that change.
Picky suggestion, but I still think it would be me.
Do you want a description of that, Commissioner? We have someone, Jeannie Munoz, who can talk about it. Are you okay if we make that change? Okay.
Let's go ahead and make the change he's asking.
Okay.
All right. Sounds fairly straightforward.
Okay.
But there are specific criteria or guidelines in terms of how they have to maintain that facility, right? That's all part of the permit?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
It's consistent with a breeder permit.
Well, no, I'm not going to say there's the same requirements, but we do have reporting requirements, for example, of the holders of education display permits. For all practical purposes, with the adoption of this proposal, such a transfer, in some respects, is seen as a liberation.
Right.
In other words, that transfer is final. They're never coming back to a breeder facility, but they may be held under that education display in that educational facility under that particular permit.
Okay. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 5, trapping, transporting, and transplanting deer permit rule amendment.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Alan Kane. I'm the district leader for the South Texas Wildlife District. Now we are presenting a proposal for an application deadline for the trap, transport, and transplant permit, commonly referred to as Triple T. In the next couple slides, just a quick review of the current Triple T rules. Complete applications received by the department between September 1st and November 15th in a calendar year shall be approved or denied within 45 days. Applications may also be received by the department through March 31st, and deer may be relocated, whitetail deer may be relocated between October 1st and March 31st. That's a 7-month time frame for folks to get us an application and apply for a Triple T permit. In addition, the Triple T rules also require field approval of the wildlife management plan for the release site, field approval of the trap site and release site portions of the Triple T application form, and most important, on-site habitat inspection for the release site. To ensure that property that can handle additional deer without impact the negative impact to that native habitat out there. Parks and Wildlife staff have concerns with the current March 31 deadline because the majority of the Triple T applications are received after January 1st. For example, in the 2007-2008 Triple T season, we had 77 permits, Triple T permits issued. 51 of those occurred after February 1. Now, that may not seem like a lot of permits, 77, but it represents 146 release sites. 87 of those occurred in my district, in the South Texas district alone. I've got 10 staff to handle that aside from the other job duties and responsibilities out there. Field staff are constrained by these late Triple T requests and the necessity to complete habitat inspections for the triple T's and make sure we're meeting the demands of the triple T program, aside from providing equitable time to our other job duties out there. And as a result, other parks and wildlife programs are being sacrificed in order to accomplish these late triple T requests that are coming in, including the Managed Lands Deer Permit Program, which is habitat-based program and requires habitat on-site habitat inspections. Staff proposed the following rule change as a solution to this issue, and that rule change would read, all triple T applications must be received by department staff no later than January 2nd of the permit year, the current permit year, and all applications submitted to the department submitted to department staff will require the trap site, release site portion of that application, the number of deer to be trapped and the release be designated on that application. Now, I know the commission has seen this presentation four times. We've had a January 1 deadline. Staff realized that January 1st is a holiday, the agency's closed, and so it didn't make sense to have the deadline being on a day the agency's closed. We moved it to the 2nd. So that's the only small difference. I wanted to make y'all aware of that. To date, we've received 26 online responses from our Parks and Wildlife website. 12 were in favor of the deadline, 14 opposed. Two of those that were opposed to the deadline indicated that they didn't want deer trapping to occur at all in the state. The other 12 that were opposed to the deadline just didn't want the deadline at all. The two just didn't want deer trapping at all. I've had conversations myself and other staff. I've had conversations with private consultants, landowners, land managers, helicopter pilots that do some of the deer trapping out there, and they've expressed support for this January 2nd deadline, or some suggested a January 15th deadline. Some of their reasonings were, for example, a trap site, a landowner that has a trap site trying to move deer off. If he had an early deadline, it's going to potentially let him know whether those release sites can accept deer or accept the number of deer he's trying to get off. If that's not the case, then he still has other alternatives through Managed Lands deer permits or maybe general season, late season, to harvest his deer population and get that number down to an acceptable level. And then on the other side of the coin, we've heard release sites, for example. Some of those folks come to us. I had a call yesterday for a release site in Kinney County. They don't have a wildlife management plan in place. They don't have population survey data. You know, obviously, we haven't conducted habitat inspection on the place. So if we had this early deadline, it helps us facilitate getting that plan set up with them. Maybe they could do a survey real quick and get them set up so they can potentially receive that permit, you know, or at least we could go through the process. In addition, we've had some release sites. We go out there and say, yeah, you can handle some extra additional deer, but we think you need to remove a few deer off the property in order to facilitate a hole in that herd where you can maintain that steady deer population, and then they have time to meet that through harvest, you know, versus a later deadline. This proposal has also been presented to the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee back this past October, and they expressed support for the January 2nd deadline. We've also presented this to the Texas Wildlife Association Executive Committee in November. At that time, there was no opposition, but they wanted to discuss it further with their internal Whitetail Deer Committee. Once they did that, their Whitetail Deer, the TWA's Whitetail Deer Committee, and I guess their executive leadership now did not support our January 2nd deadline. We've also presented this to the Texas Deer Association, a few of their members and leadership, and they did not express support for our January 2nd deadline. And they've recommended alternatives from January 20th, as early as that, to February 1st, and you know, just in conversation as late as March 1st. So they definitely not in support of this January 2nd deadline. In summary, I'd like the commission to understand that our research in South Texas on stem count sampling or habitat browse surveys indicates that winter sampling is the best time period to conduct these habitat inspections to determine deer impact on the native range out there. Because it occurs just during that winter period, there's a short time window for us to accomplish these browse surveys. Obviously, that doesn't allow a lot of time to get, you know, triple T and MLDP browse surveys done, Both require those habitat inspections, so there is some competing interest between the two programs while trying to provide equitable time to other job duties out there. We feel that the January 2nd deadline provides flexibility in planning by our field staff to address current Triple T demands and plus be able to get these MLDP properties. And hopefully, we don't look at it as a hindrance to the landowner. It's, you know, it's a deadline to help us get to them, and it's not the complete application. Again, I just want to reiterate that. It's just that the trap site and the release site forms with the number of deer to be trapped and released on those properties. Staff feel that to maintain the integrity of the MLDP program, which is habitat-based, we need to continue to conduct these habitat inspections on those places. They're important for us to help gauge whether our management practices and management recommendations we're making to these landowners are meeting their goals and objectives and maintaining that healthy native habitat out there. Staff feel that deadline later than January 2nd will not meet our current needs and allow us the flexibility to address these Triple T concerns. And that concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer those.
Yes, sir, Duggan.
Sorry. I would like to ask you whether the January 2 date should be tweaked to be the first Monday following January 1 in case January 2 falls on a Saturday or Sunday. Any consideration given to trying to set it on a business day closest to January 1?
We didn't consider that. I think that's a reasonable request. I mean, you're talking just a few days, and I may ask Clayton Wolf if he has any comment.
Clayton, do you want to speak to that real quickly, please?
For the record, I'm Clayton Wolf, director of the Big Game Program. And, Commissioner, to address your question, I think Alan's done a good job. That sounds reasonable, I believe, and I don't recall if Alan mentioned this, but the way we envision the rules, and I believe the way they're written, is if they're postmarked or received by January 2nd, but having the first business day of January, not a holiday, is reasonable, and we would be willing to support that.
That's one suggestion. The second one is among the criteria that must be contained with the application, we don't list the fee. And we discussed last time, I believe, that the fee ought to be paid up front, of course, because the fee is based on the work to be done in connection with a permit evaluation. It's not a permit fee. So I continue to push for the payment of the fee at the time the application is made. I just want to make that point clear.
And in fact, I was involved in that the permit fee increase when we went through that process and the methodology. And the one thing that I would like to clarify is when we did that, we took all field staff work associated with MLDs, and that could include some work for permits that did not get approved. But we basically, we have very specific project codes in the Wildlife Division, and one is for Triple T work. And we took all of our manpower, travel, gas, anything we charged for that, and then we divided that among the number of release sites to come up with our price. So in a way, we are capturing everything, or at least using the methodology we used at that time, we were capturing all of the department's expense, including enforcement expense as well. We also got estimates from law enforcement division. So we tried to capture all of our expenses, regardless of whether it was an approved permit or not.
And then that would only leave the question of whether we have a collection issue, which I don't believe we do.
No, sir.
I think the other part of that, Commissioner, is that any fees that we collect from the permittees would come in the same fiscal year, irrespective of whether we collected them at the start or the end, as we've traditionally
right.
done. So we do collect those fees here in the traditional year, or in the same fiscal year, and that's a help. So I know that's not your specific question, but I did want to make sure there was clarity there.
No, my position is that the application fee ought to be paid at the time the application is submitted. Period. That's just my position.
Sheriff Falcone.
Yes. Under the current rule, it says that a deer must be relocated by the 31st of March. And my question is, in order to accommodate some of the comments that some of these organizations have made, could we move to a January 15th date and move that March 31st 2 weeks up to allow you all the time to do the work that you need to do?
You're asking if we ought to set our deadline at January 15th and move their deer trapping deadline back to March?
Yeah, well, it seems like we're constrained in time because of our 31st March deadline.
Right.
And it seems like some of these organizations just want a little bit more time into January. So in order to compromise, could we maybe consider the middle of January as the filing deadline? And in order to allow you to do the things that you need to do to approve these applications, move that deadline from the 31st of March to the middle of April. In other words, just move the whole thing over.
I think, well, to answer the first part of the question, our staff are scheduled out 6 to 10 weeks in advance. There's a lot going on. Now, they don't know every single day what they're doing, but they know that they're going to have multiple assignments, you know, whether it's meeting with landowner on helicopter surveys or a tax evaluation plan or whatever it is, but there's going to be lots of things coming up, and we looked at those deadlines. We even looked at early deadlines, November 15th when we were discussing all this, December 15th, January 15th, later in February, and we just didn't feel like that would meet our demands or our needs to address the customer needs. If we wait later, then there's the likelihood we're not going to get to those folks, even to the 15th, because a lot of the guys are already scheduled out into March. And then Clayton may have other comments, but I have heard folks, you know, that moving deer a little later, those does are pregnant. Most of them are already bred. And so maybe you run the risk of causing some stress on that doe, which could potentially impact or maybe abort the fetus in there, which could cause some problems.
That's correct. And also the temperatures. By the time you get into April, you know, handling animals when it's that hot, and obviously we can't predict the weather, but the break-off point was chosen because of pregnant does, and also because a lot of this trapping occurs in South Texas, and by the time you get into April, it's pretty hot, and so for the welfare of the animal, probably not wise to be doing trapping during April.
In addition, you know, when we're looking at our habitat inspections out there, as you get into that mid to late March, it's beginning to get hard to read the habitat because you're starting that new growing season. You can't determine a full year's use because you're seeing the new growth on that stem tip, you know, and so that's why we try to keep those surveys in and keep that would suggest a deadline of January 2nd or the first business day, as Commissioner Duggins has indicated.
Just a couple of general comments. Staff has obviously spent a lot of time in looking at, you know, what they feel is an efficient allocation of workload in order to accomplish our mission, and so I certainly weight that pretty heavily, as well as the work of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. I mean, there's a reason we have an advisory committee, and they've certainly vetted this and thought through it with staff pretty thoroughly and conclusively. So I think the idea of taking a look at, you know, the next workday is one that has merit, but other than that, I would suggest that we support the staff recommendation.
Yeah. I want to echo what Dan just said about the work of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. I think they met twice on this, didn't they?
On this particular issue, I believe we just met once, but then we had subsequent meetings and follow-up meetings, but we do agree. We did lay this out there well in advance and deliberated, and we understand that there's a difference of opinion on this, but so, we have been in discussions for many months.
I also want to add, we're great partners with TWA and TDA.
Yeah.
We certainly work well with them, and we've listened to the concerns, and I just want to make sure we have circled back to the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee with that input. Is that
since
our last meeting?
We visited with the chairman, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. Executive Director Smith did visit with the chairman on that issue. We will, of course, we will have another meeting April 14th, but by that time, I'm assuming this item will be adopted.
And TWA and TDA both have representatives on the advisory committee.
I was going to ask if they did.
Yes, they did.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also I think you'll have a chance tomorrow to hear from representatives from the Deer Association, Wildlife Association, who will bring forth their specific concerns about that tomorrow in the public hearing.
So just to refresh my memory on process here, do we need to make an adjustment to incorporate the possibility of looking at what Commissioner Duggan suggested?
I believe if we, if I'm not mistaken, and Ambright can correct me, but if on the record we can put that in the slide program for tomorrow and make it very clear.
Okay.
And then usually our motion slide is suggest with changes, and that's intended to incorporate those little minor adjustments.
Any other questions, thoughts, discussion? Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
Okay. I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Last, certainly not least, 2009-2010 Statewide Hunting and Fishing Proclamation. I think we're start with inland fisheries.
Yes, sir. We're going to start off today. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, I'm Phil DeRocher, the Director of Inland Fisheries. Joining me this morning is Mr. Dave Terry. He's the branch chief of the management and research branch in inland fisheries. Dave is filling in this morning for Ken, who had to be out of town because of family emergency. So Dave's going to be presenting these proposals since these come from his staff. Anyway.
Appreciate the opportunity to be here again. My name is Dave Terry for the record, and Chairman and Commissioners. What I'm going to do today is talk to you a little bit about our freshwater fishing proposed regulation changes. The first one deals with Lake Ray Roberts. Lake Ray Roberts is a 25,600-acre lake located near Denton. This lake is surrounded by state parks and a double wildlife management area and offers great fishing opportunities for a variety of species. In 1998, the department implemented some special regulations for largemouth bass. They were a 14 to 24 inch slot length limit and a 5-fish daily bag limit. Our management goals at that time were to increase trophy bass fishing opportunities. And as we showed you at the January meeting, these limits were not effective at increasing numbers of trophy bass in this population. Consequently, we have made a recommendation to change harvest regulations to the statewide 14-inch minimum and 5-fish daily bag limits. We believe these less restrictive regulations are better suited to this particular fish population and fishery. We feel like these new limits on Lake Ray Roberts will help draw more tournaments to the lake, and these tournaments may in fact yield some significant economic benefits for the local community. So largely our bass anglers are widely in support of that and the communities surrounding the lake. As far as our public comments, our public comments in this area were very favorable, both in the public hearing process and also on the department website. Let's talk a little bit about blue catfish.
Before you move on,
sure.
Ask your question. Did you consider going to a higher number, 15, 16? I'm just curious of why 14.
Well, we opted to go with the statewide 14-inch minimum size limit. You know, has been a real successful limit, you know, within the state, and the biologists have looked at growth conditions. And right now, we try to stick with, you know, some standards. I mean, not, you know what I mean? The 14, you know, it's recognizable to the public, and I think it was important. And really, the difference between a 14 and a 15 is not that great, you know. I think it'll be great, this Thank limit you. On this lake. In regards to blue catfish, anglers are beginning to support the idea of creating trophy fishing opportunities for catfish and are now becoming more open to the possibilities of more restrictive size limits. To explore these opportunities in Texas, we propose an experimental length limit, a slot limit to be exact, on three reservoirs which we believe have high trophy fish potential. Under the special limit, anglers would be expected to release all fish between 30 and 45 inches. We would also allow harvest of 25 fish per day, but only one of those fish could be over the slot limit, over the 45-inch slot limit. Currently, these experimental populations that we're proposing are managed with blue catfish and channel catfish are managed with statewide limits, a 12-inch minimum and a 25-fish daily bag limit. The candidate reservoirs for this work would be Lake Waco in McLennan County, Lake Louisville in Denton County, and Richland Chambers Reservoir in Navarro County. We feel like the benefits of these experimental catfish regulations will be that they will definitely increase the numbers of fish above 30 inches in the population. They will also increase the number of anglers who are targeting, who wish to target trophy blue catfish. Anglers would be allowed to keep only one fish over 45 inches, but this would allow an opportunity for an angler to submit a new state record if one was caught there or into our angler recognition program. It's also important information for us as we go forward to evaluate the success of this regulation change. We believe this regulation change will improve fishing opportunity and help guide future management for catfish in the state of Texas.
What is the record for blue cat?
Well, I can tell you, it's the one that was caught up at Lake Texoma, Splash. Remember the one we had up there?
I think
there?
It was 121
pounds.
Okay. Well, we had remember the length, because you're going by inches here. Do you? Okay.
I can't remember how many inches he was.
Oh, yeah. Splash was probably near 60 inches.
Yeah, he's a huge fish. The highest spring visitation ever on TFXC was
right after that.
We had Splash.
I'll bet.
It's amazing how much interest there is in these large catfish. So. As far as public comments, we had 7 people who spoke out in favor of this proposal at our public hearings, and 5 were against, but we had overwhelming support based on our input that we received through our Texas Parks and Wildlife website, 218 comments in favor, 28 against. The other column there means other comments that we've received either by phone or by email.
What would be some reason people would be against this?
Well, you know, it's doing something different than we've been doing, you know, normally with catfish management. I mean, catfish management in the past has been real focused on harvest, and that's still a very important part of catfish fishing. And I think some people, you know, are holding on to the harvest and, you know, catching a big catfish. Let's keep it, you know, let's fill that cooler up. This one is the idea, like we've done with bass limits, where if you protect those fish and release them, they'll grow up and survive to be caught another day, increasing the quality of fishery. And it's about creating a diversification, you know, really in our catfish angling across the state. We use catfish for so many ways in Texas, for harvest, now for trophy fishing opportunities in our neighborhood fishing program and such. So we're looking and exploring other ways that we could. I think they're the second most sought after species in Texas, catfish, behind largemouth bass.
Why, help me remember, why you proposed to do this in only these 3 reservoirs and not the rest of the reservoirs?
Well, these three reservoirs, based on our survey work that we've done there, you know, have strong blue catfish populations, have historically produced some big fish. We feel like they have great potential, you know, to really be more in terms of trophy fishing there. Also, we believe that there's a lot of research that's gone on in other parts of the country, including Oklahoma, some in Texas, have shown that winterline jug lining is a very efficient way to catch these large blue catfish in the wintertime. And so where that activity is going on, we feel like there is opportunities, great opportunities for harvest, and that, you know, if that could be curtailed some, we could increase the size of these catfish for more anglers. Again, we're trying it on 3 lakes.
Mr. Dugans, the way we have done things in the past, if we have a regulation that we want to look at before we make a statewide change, we will generally do it. Experimental regulation changes on some reservoirs and evaluate it before we make it a statewide effort.
What's the length of time of your experimental regulation?
We're gonna be watching it every year. We're putting extra effort on these reservoirs, and I imagine in 3 or 4 years we should know whether or not we're being effective enough.
Yeah, and actually it might take just a little bit more time because these catfish are, you know, they're big and they're fairly slow growing, you know.
They live a long time.
Yeah, and it, you know, we're going to be monitoring annually, I think, you know, probably for the next 5 or 6 years, you know. But we should start seeing indications. The study is already starting, so we have some preliminary data that we'll capture before the regulation, if it's implemented, if you choose to do that, so we can look at before versus after.
What's the downside to expanding the sample area from these three reservoirs to include, for example, Texoma, if we can do that? I guess, does that require...
Well, there's a recommendation here for Texoma. We're doing it in conjunction with the state of Oklahoma. We could have expanded it, but we would like to show that it's going to be successful before we do this on a statewide effort. And I'm not sure the growth rate of blue cats in all the lakes in the state would be able to support this kind of regulation. You know, we have some populations that the catfish grow fairly slowly, and they may never get into this size limit. You know, we may not achieve what we want to achieve at the end. But this is the approach we've always taken when we're looking at something that potentially could go statewide. We want to experiment.
Our next proposal deals with Lake Texoma. Our department meets regularly with the Oklahoma Agency to share results of our fisheries surveys and discuss management options at Lake Texoma. Through the years, we've made considerable efforts to help standardize the regulations between the Texas and Oklahoma sides of the reservoir. This helps reduce angler confusion about regulations. It also aids law enforcement efforts. The Oklahoma Agency has put into place now a one fish per day daily bag limit for LA Gator Gar and a May spawning closure in the upper end of the reservoir. We support these management actions and desire to reciprocate Texas waters. The Texas closure would be in the Hagerman National Wildlife Refuge area and from the U.S. Highway 377 bridge to the I-35 Interstate Highway bridge during that same time frame. In regards to blue catfish, and also that GAR regulation went into place January 1st, 2009. In regards to blue catfish, the Oklahoma Agency has recently approved a statewide one fish per day over 30-inch rule for blue catfish, which impacts Lake Texoma. The total bag limit there would remain at 15 fish. This will go into effect on the Oklahoma side of the reservoir beginning January 1st, 2010. We support this management action and would like to reciprocate, of course, on the Texas side and keep regulations consistent on the lake. As far as public commentary, few comments were made on this proposal during the public hearing process. However, comments made on the Texas Parks and Wildlife website showed good support for these changes. The next is just a little bit of housekeeping. Pound Lake in Travis County is currently managed with a 14 to 21-inch slot length limit for largemouth bass. This lake was recently renamed to honor the legacy of Lady Bird Johnson. This reservoir is now called Lady Bird Lake. So what we propose to do is make this name change in the Texas Parks and Wildlife Proclamation. Alligator gar. Interest in this species as a trophy fish has increased in recent years. Information on gar species is generally limited because they're often difficult to catch in standardized fishery surveys, and also populations have become depleted, you know, in many areas of the country. Texas is blessed. We do have good numbers of gar here. Numerous states, though, have joined forces through the American Fisheries Society to combine data sets and discuss options for management to ensure the viability of the species and to ensure that we have to maintain these valuable fisheries that we have. Alligator gars have been listed as a species of concern in two states, Oklahoma and Kentucky. Populations have been extirpated in states of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. And the species was recently listed as vulnerable by the American Fisheries Society, which is the professional society of the fisheries business. This was done by the AFS Endangered Fishes Committee. Here are the current regulations for alligator gar in the southern United States. At our January meeting, y'all asked us to for the reasons why these states had these limits. So what we did is we went ahead and contacted each of these states and asked them for the reasons why. Most states enacted these regulations in response to declining populations or a shrinking range of the alligator gar. Some states, though, like Oklahoma and Arkansas, are also concerned about the potential for overexploitation by angling. Both those states have some populations of alligator gar remaining. Many have actually enacted these regulations with little or no data, and some desire to make their regulations more restrictive than they currently are, based on the new information that's coming forward with this species. Arkansas has expressed an interest in using data from Texas to help build their case for more restrictive regulations next year. So Texas is definitely contributing to that database of fish. Here's the alligator gar distribution in Texas. It's approximate. The shaded area of the map shows this where these fish exist. We know we have viable populations in the Trinity River system, quite a few there, and a few reservoirs in Texas, and also in our coastal bays and estuaries. It's important to note that alligator gar really are only one of four species of gar in the state of Texas. There is generally less recreational interest in the long nose, the spotted, and the short nose gar. Alligator gar, of course, get very, very large. So do long nose gar, but alligator gar get big as well. But the alligator gar has a unique life history that make them particularly vulnerable to depletion through harvest or changing environmental conditions. So let's talk a little bit about life history. The alligator gar are a long-lived fish. You know, a large female might be between 50 and 75 years. Populations experience take a long time or generally experience low annual mortality, and few fish actually make it to this trophy size. Alligator gar take a long time to become sexually mature. Males become mature at about 8 years old, and females become mature at about 12 years old.
Are you saying that this slide suggests that the female has to be about 60 inches in length before it's able to mature?
Yes, sir. Yep. And that's based on a lot of information that was collected in Louisiana that is a foundation for a lot of the, supplemented with Texas and other states, is the foundation for the life history information, you know, when they become mature and stuff. So, anyway, but yeah, they got to be 60 inches before they'll be mature and can spawn. Males get there, they grow slower. Males grow slower and get there earlier. Alligator gar need flooded terrestrial vegetation and specific water temperatures to spawn successfully. These conditions do not occur in Texas every year, and they are expected to occur less frequently in the future as water demands in the state increase. Here is some current information we have from Texas. We began investigations on alligator gar in Sam Raven Reservoir in the late 1980s. There we conducted some food habit studies and learned that alligator gar consume what's probably most abundant, but gizzard shad, channel catfish, and freshwater drum. Populations in Rayburn at that time were dominated by a few year classes of large fish, and those year classes were subsequently removed from harvest. The population was depleted in a matter of a couple of years. It's important to note that there was no noticeable negative impact, on game fish populations both before and after the presence of alligator gar. Also, there's a lot of current research currently going on in Texas. What we're doing is we're looking at size structure of populations, year class strengths of populations. We're doing a marker capture study in the Upper Trinity River to estimate population size. We're looking at seasonal habitat use and movements of these fish. We've got radio tags planted in some gar. We're continuing some work with food habits work. We're beginning to work and look at contaminants. We're building knowledge and databases on age and growth and comparing those to age and growth studies that have been done in other areas. And we're working in collaboration with the Coastal Fisheries Division on genetic studies in the bays and estuaries. When we look at length frequencies of alligator gar, what you'll notice is the big difference between the length frequencies that we see in Texas and what we see in Louisiana, which also have abundant populations of gar, is that we have very, very large fish. You know, and it's these large fish that make Texas a popular fishing destination for alligator gar. These fish would be difficult to replace if populations became overexploited, mainly because of their unique life history characteristics. So the current status is that Texas has the best remaining gar populations in the country. We believe that we have a window of opportunity to protect these populations and this fishery. Our management goals are simply to sustain trophy harvest and to ensure viable populations into the future. And to attain these goals, we would recommend that we reduce harvest to sustainable levels and ID and protect critical habitats. So our proposal is to limit harvest to one alligator gar per day. That would apply to both commercial and recreational anglers. We believe it's a good first step in managing gar into the future. And we, of course, would continue our research work on alligator gar and adjust those rules if needed. Here are the public comments that were taken at the hearing and the website. There was quite a few, 79 spoke out against the proposal and 2-4 at our public hearing process. The web, however, was kind of a reverse of that. And the web, we had 231 comments in favor, 92 against. You may be wondering what the other is. Those are people who are also against proposal for a specific reason. And about 30% of those people felt like our regulation ought to be more restrictive. So, anyway, but that's, and of course 30% thought it should be less restrictive. But anyway.
So public hearing.
Yes, sir.
79 against. Where did you hold those public hearings?
Oh.
About 50 locations all around the state. It was part of the public hearing process that we had to vet all these regulations, even fisheries, wildlife. They were all over the state.
Oh.
And most of the people that were testifying in opposition were bow fishermen.
These are primarily fish with bow?
Right.
Yes, and they don't want the restrictions?
No.
They want no restrictions as we have now, which there's no limit at all, is there? Okay.
Before we get into the real question, and here I have a little video here I'd like to show you all. That this is very unique. It's only about 2 minutes. This video was taken by a biologist in Oklahoma in May of 2007 after we had the big flood at Lake Texoma. He just happened to be checking on the results of the flood, and he came across this flooded area and these big alligator gar spawning. It's very, very unique, and I'd just like to take 2 minutes and watch this. Not many people have ever seen this.
We have a bunch of them in there, right?
They estimated 50 or 60 of them in that pod.
Look at that.
This is Texan.
Right.
Do they spawn every year?
No. That's the problem. They need this flooded.
They need that flooded.
Right. So we may be looking at 1 year class of fish here.
Yeah.
Those are big creatures.
Mm-hmm. What is quote unquote the state record?
302 pounds, I believe. Caught in the Rio Grande back in the 50s. There are probably not many left in the Rio Grande now.
No,
not many
I wouldn't think so.
What reach?
I think it was lower Rio Grande. Watch this. Swimming right up to his feet. But the thing that makes this so unique is you can see how vulnerable these fish are at this time when they're in this, going through this spawning activity. But the thing that amazes us as biologists is you have to realize that any young gar that hatched from this spawning activity, it'll be 8 to 15 years before they reach maturity. And it'll be 30 to 50 years before they get to this size. So a lot of things can happen in 30 to 50 years.
Yeah, they don't really think this. Yeah.
Okay. Any questions?
Quickly going back to the research, obviously we're doing good things to gain more information. I'm looking back at the slide that shows the river systems and the different projects we have going on. When do you think we'll have more information, conclusive information, and to what extent do you think we can reasonably expect that you'd ever be able to correlate offtake to to population and recruitment?
Well, what we're back when we asked the research people at Harder to Hills to look into the GAR situation, they had some population models that are used to check, try to estimate the size of the trophy potential or the size of the population of trophies. And the results of that modeling concerned us because it showed that really the populations are fairly small when you consider all the people that want to find them. So we're out collecting information so we can go in and verify what that model showed us before we'll make any more recommendations or suggestions. And I'm thinking it'll probably take 2 years. Some of the stuff we'll know fairly quickly. We're looking at contaminants. There's been some questions about whether these fish are, and you know, when you look at their life history, they get very large, they live a long time, they're a top predator. You would expect that there'd be some issues with contaminants. But we're going to look at that, and we should have some of those results before the end of this year, and this movement studies.
You listed two goals in the presentation. One was to reduce the harvest. The other was to ID and protect critical habitat. The proposal obviously seeks to address goal one. What about goal two?
Go ahead.
The study that we're doing right now with the radio telemetry study we have 38 radio transmitters in these fish on the lower Trinity River, and we're going to be able to monitor their movements, look at them through a spawning cycle, several spawning cycles, and be able to know what habitats they're using and which ones are important to them. Some studies that are already being done right now in Arkansas have looked at, you know, associations between river flow hydrology in a system and what that water would flood at certain times, correlating that also with water temperature specific parameters that need to be in place to identify areas that have potential that could be very important for gar reproduction. But in Texas, we really haven't identified those areas. We have taken the data that we have with the length frequency information, and we have, which is in the Trinity, and have compared that to the hydrology, and have been able to, you know, look at productions of year classes in associations with high flow times.
Yeah, we are addressing that through this telemetry study. We've got the fish tagged, and we're going to be tracking them throughout the year. And if they all end up in the same place during the spawning season, then we're probably going to make that place off limits.
Well, how did Oklahoma identify that particular area of Texoma and decide to say that's off limits in May?
That's where this video came from. They just happened upon this after that flooding.
Well, they didn't know that was a spot.
No, he didn't know that was there. He was just out on the reservoir, and he saw this activity, went home and got his camera and came back and videoed it. And that's why that particular area was listed, because they know it happens there.
And is there any kind of coordination with the law enforcement to suggest to the wardens that if they see any spawning activity that they'll somehow report back to you so you can try to use that as an identification?
We haven't thought of that, but that's a very good idea. Pete, I'm sure Pete will help us with that.
And we'll continue to work with our anglers. A lot of the data that we do have on the Trinity River, these 289 fish, came with a cooperative work with a local angler there who actually tagged those fish. And what we're doing is they tag those fish and then doing a marker capture to estimate a population size for the Trinity River. And, you know, we're open to working with our anglers, our bow anglers, our rod and reel anglers, our commercial anglers to help us identify some of these areas that might be important. It's going to take some time on the water for sure.
So you do have commercial anglers?
Yes, sir. Currently,
you cut to one a day. I assume your commercial angling is pretty much gone.
Right. Well, yeah, it's going to be very limited. We have, I think, and I looked at the latest information, and I have it here, somewhere here. Well, I had it when we started. Yeah, here it is. For a person to be a commercial fisherman, he has to have a permit to sell non-game fish in the state of Texas. And and every year they have to submit a report saying what they caught and what they sold and what price they received. And we have 17 active permits in the state of Texas. Most of them are in the Liberty, Trinity River area. We have several of them at Choke Canyon in South Texas. Most of these people reported, at least, a minimum catch of alligator gar. That there were several of them that were very substantial. One gentleman living in Mercedes, and I think his reports that he fishes the whole coast of Texas, all the way from Livingston. He reported catching 38,200 pounds of gar.
How much?
38,200 pounds of gar. He sold those for $2.25 a pound. So he's the only guy that could actually be making a living on gar.
Catching those in what way? Nets? How's
no, you can't fun? Catch them in nets. They use jug lines, jugs, right? A special jug, a special way of rigging a jug for catching big gar. We kind of invented that for them when we did it on Sam Rayburn. We did the food habit study. We showed them how to catch them.
What period of time was that number?
That's for a year.
That's 1 year.
One year?
Yeah. He may have some others working with him or something. I don't know. You catch that much on your own. Okay.
He has some helpers, I imagine.
I'm sorry?
He has some helpers. I'm
yeah.
Sure.
I'm back to your map here, and you're showing everything from no harvest to no limit ourselves in Louisiana to 50 a day. I guess that's Missouri. All over the map for what reasons? Give me an example. Florida. Did you visit with Florida? Why no harvest at all?
Well, they don't have any gar.
Oh, they just don't have gar.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
They don't think they have any. They're very, very remnant population, so they don't allow any. You know, with all the damming, and they just don't have those kind of flood events that they
anymore.
That's required,
okay.
Right? Some of these states, actually, Kentucky is actually going to try to start restocking alligator gar to kind of bring their populations back.
Where would they get that stock? Are they farm raising it? I mean, how do they?
Yeah, they're going to raise them themselves. I think there's a federal hatchery in that area that is experimenting with producing gar.
Have we ever fooled with that?
It's Tennessee.
Not yet.
Tennessee.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. There is.
From no harvest to 50.
Well, or none, like we have. See, we have. I mean, there's no limit in our case, theoretically.
I think Missouri kind of matches what they do with paddlefish, and I don't think they have any. They don't have
per
any.
Day. That's a combined total of lots of conglomeration of a bunch of fish.
Okay,
that's in the Mississippi. You know, the Mississippi River there's runs. That's where most of that activity takes place.
Yeah, you know, again, I thank you all for coming up here because I know you're really concerned about this, and there's been some other comments and. I really think we should consider this recommendation seriously.
I agree. I think the important point here is that we're actively engaged in research that we think will be productive within the next couple of years. And there's a lot of interest, obviously, in the fish. So the other point I would make is that, you know, particularly with a significant reduction in the commercial offtake, you know, what may come out of that research is that it could be liberalized. I mean,
right.
we don't know. You're just suggesting that it's a first step, but potentially a second step is liberalizing. Having said that, that's a huge fish, and one per day is pretty significant.
Well, it's similar to a tarpon or a shark on the marine side.
We're reducing opportunity with that kind of opportunity. Certainly want to keep looking at it. So, any other questions?
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Robin Rikers, and I'm here to present to you the Coastal Fisheries statewide proposals. As you all recall, our public hearing proposals were comprised of three different proposals. One is a paddlecraft guide license. The other is a suite of several species looking at consistency with federal regulations. And then lastly, we had proposals regarding recreational commercial flounder fishery. Just to kind of recap, it's been a long process. We had 10 different scoping meetings at the following locations listed there. We also formed a recreational commercial work group who each met two times, and the last time they actually met together. And then we had these 47 hearings across the state, of which we had comments coming about our proposals from 13 of those hearings. When you break that comment summary down, it basically looks like that, about 6,500 in the scoping phase, close to a little over 4,000 in the public hearing phase of comments in regards to some portion of these rules. And the organizations who commented are listed there. And I'm going to go through those because you're going to hear from some of those organizations a little bit tomorrow, and I'll give you hopefully a little bit of a preview of what they're going to say to you. Coastal Bend Guides Association supported the flounder proposal. They opposed the kayak portion or the paddlecraft license proposal. The Coastal Conservation Association supported the bag limits of five, movement from 10 to 5 on the recreational side and from 60 to 30 on the commercial side. They did not support the November closure as we had it. They supported an October, November, and December closure only to the gig fishery. The Port Aransas Boatmen's Association and the Saltwater Enhancement Association both spoke in favor of the flounder proposals in our scoping phase, and I don't know if that's where they will still be after we had a proposal, but they did at that time speak in favor of it. The Recreational Fishing Alliance asked us to have a 10-fish recreational and commercial bag limit on flounder, and they supported a November closure. They also opposed our shark regulations and our trigger fish proposals, or our federal consistency proposals. In addition, I might add, and I missed it when I was up there with Coastal Conservation Association, they supplemented their position on flounder with support of the sharks and greater amberjack proposal, and on gray triggerfish, they suggested that we have a 10-inch minimum size limit and a 10-fish bag limit. The last two, Ocean Conservancy, had a petition with over 350 signatures on it supporting all the federal consistency proposals. The only thing they suggested beyond that was that we should look at upping the minimum size limit on the three fish that we're not considering upping the minimum size limit on sharks on. And they also asked for proactive measures regarding some shark species, which is now going through the federal process under HMS Highly Migratory Species Amendment 3. And then lastly, we got a letter from the Pew Environmental Group supporting our consistency measures on greater amberjack, gray triggerfish, and gag grouper. Next, I'll move into the actual proposals, and again, kind of like I did in when we briefed you last time, I'll stop at the end of each one. If there's any questions regarding those proposals, I'll try to deal with those while we're on them. Again, when we looked at this paddlecraft guide endorsement, we looked at the current requirements, and basically the current requirements would be that you have an all-water guide license, which requires you to have a United States Coast Guard operator of uninspected passenger vessel, captain's license, if you will, and then it to get that, it requires you to have 360 days of sea time. And so it was brought to our attention and a request to us to look at this. And, of course, that 360 days of sea time, if you're not going to be on a powerboat, is pretty difficult for you to certify. And the other aspect that we've looked at is that we really don't believe that that time on that powerboat allows you to really address some of the unique safety issues associated with paddlecraft. So our proposal that was published in the Register was to require a TPWD boater safety course, a CPR and first aid course, and either one of two, you can choose either the American Canoe Association or the British Canoe Union certification, but you basically have to go through a two-step course level there. And that would be the American Canoe Association Level 2 Essentials of Kayak Touring and Coastal Kayak Trip Leading. And if you did the British Canoe Union certification, it would be the 3-star Sea Kayak and then the 4-star Leader Sea Kayak. When we look at our comments regarding this proposal, you see we've had considerable comments in favor of the proposal, running at about 89% with 210 people speaking, those opposed about 25 and 11%. Mostly the opposition at the public hearing came from people who didn't think this was inclusive enough of overall general boating safety and the issues that you might have out there in just overall general boating safety. Some people suggest it's not as stringent as the USC Coast Guard requirements. And then lastly, some of those people are calling for a drug testing situation in regards to people who are in those kayaks and guiding.
Now, we have a proposed amendment to the change as published in the register, and what we would propose upon further inspection of those second courses that were listed there, it's a prerequisite to have those first courses or a course that teaches you those same skills. And some of them may actually allow you to take one or the other course, and then it allows you to go to that second tier course. So it's our belief that we can accomplish the same skill level by just listing those two last courses in that suite of courses. And that way it also reduces the amount of paperwork someone will have to bring into our licensed deputy's office and actually make sure they have with them, and it also reduces the amount of paperwork we have to then certify as it's appropriate, and it's, you know, it allows us to have that license. But the requirement essentially ends up being the same thing. So we would suggest that change. That kind of concludes that section on paddlecraft licensing. Are there any questions?
Sure, Duggan.
How many people are affected by this?
We really believe it's, at this point, it's a small number who have asked and kind of come forward and said, you know, we'd like for you to look at this. I'm going to just throw a number out just based on, and this is just hearsay at this point, but maybe 14, 20, 25 in that neighborhood. Now, we believe this is where a growing segment may be, and so certainly anything we can do to allow people who either are doing it and not being licensed appropriately or to allow growth in that segment, that's kind of why we're looking at this change.
Any questions on that? Okay,
we'll move on to the federal regulation consistency and in specific the shark item. Again, our proposal was to match the federal prohibited shark list of 21 species. And then for those other species which we allow take on, we would increase the minimum size limit to 64 inches total length, which is equivalent to the 54 inches fork length that the federal minimum size limit is. Now, when saying that, we're maintaining our bag limit and our minimum size limit at 24 inches total length for Atlantic shark nose, bonnethead, and black tip. In the other species that we're considering for regulation consistency, we're considering increasing the minimum length from 32 to 34 inches for total length on greater amberjack, and reducing the bag limit. Actually, the bag limit today is one fish per person per day, so that will remain the same. On great triggerfish, we're establishing a 14-inch minimum length limit, 20 per person, and a 20 per person daily bag limit. Now, we're going to have a subsequential change on that proposed as we get to that. And then on gag, we're establishing a 22-inch minimum length limit, 2 per person per day bag limit. When you look at the proposals and the support and opposition of those proposals, you see that basically for the most part we're running around 90% support and roughly 10% in opposition. As we talk about the federal rule consistency, our comment summary, if you will, those who are in support basically asked us for greater protection, and that was either greater, mostly on the shark side of the world, greater protection through the raising those other minimum length limits. There was some discussion about setting up some of those sharks where it's one per person per year based or only on an if it's a record kind of fish like we've done on tarpon and other species. When you talk about those who were against, again, it's this issue over concern of the federal data and how we get from those federal issues and the data that goes into those management recommendations that come forward. And then lastly, on sharks, it's the identification issues regarding sharks. And as we've already talked with a lot of folks about, we're going to make a real push on education, and the feds have already made a real push on education regarding identification, and the state's going to take that up as well as much as we can to help them support that notion. The rule change that I wanted to bring forward or the consistency change that I wanted to bring forward was on gray triggerfish. And again, this is a proposed amendment to what was published in the Texas Register, and it would be that we would establish a 16-inch minimum length limit total length instead of the 14-inch total length that was proposed. To be consistent, the federal regulation is 14-inch fork length, and I, in fact, talked about how confusing that was at the last meeting, and along the way we got confused ourselves and had a fork length measurement in there instead of a total length measurement. That concludes my presentation for that side.
Well, as long as we're talking about being consistent, why do we use total length as opposed to the fork length, and surely that creates more issues with the fishermen than not.
The feds use both, quite frankly. They go back and forth, depending on the species. Years ago, here in Texas, in the saltwater, we tried to go to total length on all of our species. And so we're at least trying to be consistent with all of ours being total length. I don't know that we'd have much success in convincing for them to go total length on everything. We certainly have tried on that in the past because of that, you know, the difficulty. Now, what we try to do is pick a total length that if you're consistent with our rule, you'll be fine with theirs. I mean, there's always a conversion on that fork length to total length, and we're trying to make that measurement. I mean, we could match theirs totally, but we would have a hodgepodge of fork lengths and total lengths.
Is there a way you could list both?
You could list both, but it's an equation that basically makes that correlation between total length and fork length. And if we listed both, I think we'd make it real difficult on Pete's guys because, you know, they could end up with a fish that's 16-inch total length, but it may be, you know, 13.5 fork length. Any other? I'll move on then. We're going to next move on to flounder, and I present this picture again. You've seen this one now several times, but it kind of shows the current situation of the flounder stocks, basically. It shows that, you know, since the early 1980s, we've decreased that overall flounder population by about 50%, going from that kind of 0.1 figure over there on the axes, and that's a catch per unit effort in our standardized sampling, from about 0.1 to somewhere in that neighborhood of 0.04, 0.05 when you look at that. As we've talked about in the past, we see that throughout our data sets, throughout our fisheries independent data sets, and we also saw that in both the recreational and commercial catches. So our proposal that we published in the register will reduce the recreational catch from 10 to 5 fish, and reduce the commercial catch from 60 to 30 fish, and it will close November to all take a flounder as proposed. Just to remind you all of some of the numbers you were looking at last time, at this point, the proposal that we sent to the register is in green there, and of course that proposal would achieve around 100% increase in spawning stock biomass over the 6-year period, and that comes at that cost, as I described it last time, at a cost in the harvest of about 45% or a 45% decline in overall numbers. And of course that also, that particular chart or table shows you some of the other things that we talked about at the last meeting. Now, when I take you to the comment summary, flounder's a little more difficult than some of the other summaries because people could agree with the 5 and the 30, but disagree with our November closure. So when I present this to you, that's basically how I present it. If they said they agreed with 5 and 30, like the people who would have supported the CCA position, I put them in support of 5 and 30, but then I put them in opposition of the November closure. And in fact, when you look at these comments, over 7,800 of those in the scoping phase and the public hearing phase were in support of that CCA position of 530 October, November, and December. Now, when you look at it overall, and this is only the public hearing phase, you see that, you know, we pretty much had overwhelming support of the 5 fish bag limit and the 30 fish bag limit, changing the rec and the commercial bag limits. Unfortunately, I will tell you, the November closure, as you can see there, didn't receive as much support. And, of course, a lot of that is due to those 2,100 or so people from the Coastal Conservation Association who were represented here within this context of being against the November closure. Not necessarily that they're against all closures, but they didn't like this closure.
Let me stop you there, Robin, for a second. On that November closure, what they're talking about is they want to have it open for rod and reel. That would
yes.
be correct.
That's
tell me on rod and reel, visiting with people about it internally also, catching flounder with rod and reel, I never had much luck personally, but I'm not much of a fisherman. Walk me through your sense of that relative to the population and what kind of hit it might put on it if you stayed open for rod and reel in November.
Okay. Well, I have some scenarios present to you here at the end of this. But basically, when you think about the rod and reel fishery, we look at some data set where we have both of those fisheries going on, and we're actually monitoring that gig fishery as well, and that was in 1991. When you look at it overall, because there's so many recreational rod and reel anglers, they actually catch 1.6 or so fish to every one fish caught in the gig fishery. Now, that being said, that doesn't mean they're near as efficient, which is what you were getting to, which is the efficiency question about if you're a rod and reel angler out there. And so I will go into that in just a second as we move forward here. A couple other considerations that I kind of wanted to bring up that kind of are along those same lines, is first the modeling uncertainties. And certainly, given the long-term data sets that we have, I think we can do this modeling as well as anyone in the country. But certainly I need to at least make you aware that these are based on static conditions. If fishing effort goes up and fishing mortality would go up with that, then our projections of what we're going to see would actually be less. By the same token, if fishing effort goes down and fishing mortality went down subsequently with that, then we would actually end up with higher biomass than we would have projected. So that's just one of those things that we always live with in these kind of situations, but, it is based on the static conditions that we're dealing with in the model at the time. The other thing, that we always want to make note of, and it's certainly just like in the GAR scenario, we continue to have this statewide hunting fishing proclamation every year, and we look at all these species every year. And so, what we do today or tomorrow, we'll be reviewing over the course of the next several years, but what we would expect in this particular case is that within about 3 years, we'll have 90% of the impact of that rule. We'll be seeing that because of the way this fishery is. It's a six-year lived species, and so we will see 90% of the impact of this rule in that three-year time frame. In addition, I just kind of want to remind everyone, we do have a Finfish limited entry program on the commercial side. That was put in place in 1999. In the year 2000, we started with the buyback program that was developed underneath that program. Since that time, we bought about 190 licenses. We have a current round out now. We buy, on average, in the last three or four rounds, we bought about 10 to 12 licenses per round. We've got an application period out right now. We've got 21 different applications in. It just closed. We don't know how many we'll accept out of that. But certainly we're trying to get more aggressive on the finfish side of the world in regards to buyback. I want to at least make you aware as well, when it comes to the finfish license holder, they can fish for, typically those are either flounder fishermen or black drum fishermen. So it can be a combination of either or. So now as we, given the overwhelming, lack of support for the November closure at this point in time, I wanted to at least consider some of the considerations that Chairman Holt was bringing up there and give you some information that might help you in your decision. When we look at the efficiencies of these different gears from that same time frame we're talking about, what you see here is a graph regarding the 10-fish bag limit on recreational for both the rod and reel fishery and the gig fishery. And the percentages are the percentage number of trips that they had to, first of all, have a flounder in their bag, and then secondly, how many of those trips caught, 1 through 10 or greater. So what you see there when you look at the blue chart is about 80% of those people who had a flounder in the bag catch only one fish. Then after that, about 10% catch two, and the percentage that catches more than two fish starts to go way down. When you look at that compared to the recreational gig fishery, you'll see about 18% or 20% of each of those trips catch one, two, or three fish, and then it starts to go down, and then you'll see about roughly 8% of those trips catch greater than 10 fish in the current situation, or 10 fish or greater. It can't be greater anymore because we've now matched possession and bag limit, but at this time it could have been. So. Having said that, certainly if you're going to restrict the more efficient gear during that November closure, we would want to restrict the gig fishery instead of the rod and reel fishery. And if you look at that, I presented you some options here. I've got the proposal as published in green there on top, and then I've looked at options for November harvest below, and that's options for hook and line only. If you allowed hook and line to have a two-fish bag limit, you'll see that you would
basically raise your spawning stock biomass to about 80% in the time frame of 6 years. If you had a three fish bag limit, it's about 77%, and then five fish, 72%. Again, at the cost of roughly 35% in total decline in harvest numbers and about 27% in harvest weight. With that, that really concludes the presentation, so I'd be happy to answer any questions.
The closing of the gig, gigging possibilities for, what did we say, October, November, December, sorry.
Just November.
No. We had it 3 months. Originally. No, I'm talking about, I was going to ask, I'm jumping around a little bit. On the commercial side, if you close for the 3 months, as was kind of originally talked about, you'd essentially close down most, is that when most of the commercial gigging is done relative to the year-round?
You know, certainly the commercial gigging occurs during all that period of time,
yeah.
But just like the recreational fishery, a bulk of those landings come from that October, November, and December time frame.
50%, I think.
Would there,
on the slide that's up now where you have a 2 to 3, 5 fish bag limit, would there be any minimum size length on these?
I should have made that clear. Certainly within the context of any of our proposals, it still has the 14-inch minimum size limit we have in effect now. I apologize for not making that clear.
Going back to your regulation impact, showing all the numbers, which is one of the first slides, but it shows in October, December closures, the biomass increase 107.7%. Is that total closure, rod and reel, and gigging?
Yes. What we presented last time was the total closure scenarios, yes. Rod and reel and gigging.
Is there a significant difference if you just did the gigging as opposed to bumping?
For November.
No, not for the whole 3 months.
My recollection was there wasn't a big, correct me if I'm wrong, Robin, there wasn't a big difference between the 3 month and the 1 month closure in terms of spawning biomass increase. Is that correct?
Correct. There, as you see there, the November closure, 5 and 30, has it at about 102% spawning biomass, and the October to December closure, if you include the 530, would have 127%.
I guess what I'm trying to do is factor in the efficiency that you're talking about between the rod and reel and gigging into those numbers, and maybe if you don't have that data, that's fine, but I'm just curious if there's any way to sort of extrapolate if there is that number.
Well, I'm trying to make sure I understand your question. I mean, we have a lot of scenarios here,
sure.
So I'm sure we do have the number here. It's just
where is
digging it out.
Are you just trying to get at if we
I'm saying I guess I'm going to the CCA proposal is the fact that if it would be closed 3 months strictly for gigging. Do we have that number somewhere?
I don't know that we've ran that exact number, but when you look at that, when we look at getting at that number by looking at the various scenarios we've done, it's, you know, I think it's probably close to the November closure and 5 and 30 bag limit. It's getting close into that range. And, you know, I think that's one of the other things that you know, as we talk about this and this modeling is that, you know, before we could do this modeling, we would take these actions and we would look for that trend line to go up again, because that's what we really look at, is those abundance trends based on our sampling. Now, you know, this modeling is an important tool because it allows us to project out a little bit further, but certainly there's not a lot of difference between a 95% spawning biomass increase and a 97% spawning stock biomass increase. You know, we're kind of cutting hairs here that may not really be there. And when you know, certainly consider some of the environmental parameters that are changing from 1 year to the next out there.
And I may be asking the same question. I'm just getting confused with the figures here. But if we had a November closure, we allowed rod and reel in November.
Yes.
Only.
Mm-hmm.
All 3 months, but only rod and reel in November. Spawning biomass increase based on this model, the difference between that and our current proposal would be what?
the if you look at the last graph, the one I have up now, basically it's the difference between that 102.5 and 72.8, about 30 percentage points.
So that's
pretty significant difference.
If you go to five, see what he's talking about. You could theoretically in November allow some recreational rod and reel, a two fish bag limit. Now you're at 80.
Which is still a 20%.
It's still 24. Yeah.
Questions? So,
can I ask one? Okay, let's go now to the fishermen, the recreational fishermen. If you close November, now you've closed it to gigging and to any kind of fishing of any kind, not only commercial, but of course for the recreational. I'm going to ask this question exactly. Maybe you can just give me an estimate. I mean, do we have a lot of people out fishing for flounder in November? I'm trying to understand the impact relative to the recreational fishermen.
Well, certainly November, and I mean, this is why we've targeted November, is it's the spawn,
right,
and it's the time that they're moving through from the bay to the Gulf.
Right.
So, you know, I think there are a lot of people who will target a trip in October, November, and December. And certainly I think the public hearing comments suggest that there's a lot of people who have interest in that time frame. You know, is November overall one of our high effort months? No. But when it comes to flounder, it obviously is a higher effort kind of targeted fishery.
We're still increasing spawning biomass significantly.
We have to say you're right in the middle of the kind of the middle of the spawn or the main spawning month, for lack of a better term, isn't it?
Yes. When you look at, you know, November, and we looked at the various scenarios, if we just closed October, if we just closed November, or if we just closed December, November's the bigger key month here, certainly.
Okay. Any thoughts?
So I think, Commissioner, you know, there's a million different permutations on this, but I think the November month is critical. It's something that Robin and his team are saying. You know, we have the proposal now on the table in which we're going to essentially half the catch across all sectors, but with a November closure for all sectors. And so that's a proposal that we would formally present tomorrow. I think what Robin wanted to do is, you know, if you wanted to look at that question of recreational opportunity for rod and reel fisheries, which is less efficient, this would be the impact on our recovery on the spawning biomass. So that will be something for y'all to consider tomorrow.
Specific to that point, in terms of recovery in term, 80% versus, give us a sense of what that 20% delta means.
Well, if we... And I'll just go back to the slide because it'll be certainly far easier for me to show it on a slide versus me trying to describe it. In terms of recovery, that would have us going from, you know, the point in 08, 07 down here where we're at, you know, somewhere in that 0.04 range on catch per unit effort. It would have us recovering that stock back up into that 0.08 range. You know, we're not as high as maybe we've kind of targeted, but we certainly would move up there, and it would level off at that period of time.
How long would that take?
That we should see most of that, over 90% of that recovery, we should see in 3 years.
So I think it is a valid question. Is 20% sounds drastic looking at it here, it's a drastic increase.
It would be a significant increase from where we are, still a significant reduction in the overall catch. The overall catch would be, the change in reduction in overall catch is, if you keep the current proposal, your overall catch reduction is about 45% in numbers. If you went to one of those other considerations, you're more like in the 35% in overall harvest decline.
And this is sort of in a perfect world.
Sure, absolutely. I mean,
well, given the November opportunity on hook and line, I think we ought to consider it. Given that it doesn't take a long, long time for that biomass to return. So, any discussion or thoughts on that?
If we were to do it, could we do it? Try it just this year and see what the surveys show after
California, it'd show enough, would it, Robin?
Is that not enough?
Robin, I'm not a scientist. Robin,
well,
I'm worried about that, but I'm not a scientist.
I'm going to go back to one of our previous presentations where I showed you the 6-year recovery time frame and see if I can get an estimate of. Just ballpark it here if I can find that.
No, yeah, I'm not. So I think you gotta consider it.
I mean, the recovery ramps up very quickly. After year one, and unfortunately, this is a problem as we get a little older here.
You need your arms to get older,
right? Don't know if those will help, but we should see at the end of year one, and you know, obviously you're assuming a full cycle, which would include that November escapement and so forth. You're going to see about 60% of your recovery. Now, you got to remember that our sampling then comes in spring and fall. So, you know, really for us to pick that up in our sampling, you're probably going to need to go 2 years. I mean, that's the reality, because you'll get the recovery in the fishery, and then our sampling will be picking it up the subsequent season.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see. So.
But if 80% is the number, does that mean going to this chart you have up here that's the most we would get to?
Based on the modeling, it would project us going to that kind of level of abundance. Yes, we wouldn't quite get all the way back to that, you know, the first 5-year average, which is somewhere around 0.1 there in overall abundance trend. But you know, it certainly doesn't take away from you the opportunity after 3 years or 2 years to look at where we are on that recovery. If you know, assuming the model works and we reach the recovery that we expect. For you to look at it again at that point in time, for us to bring back that information to you, and you know, you have an opportunity for subsequent decisions at that point.
And at that point, I have a better sense of what a viable fishery is, because you know, is it something lower than those early numbers, or something in between? You know, the two. I don't have a sense for that at all.
Well, and certainly, if you remember, it's been quite some time ago now, when we were in Houston when I presented that temperature information. You know, that temperature information suggests there is some correlation and was having some sort of dampening effect on carrying capacity. And you know, we believe we can reach back to this point, or else we wouldn't have proposed it. But you know, we don't know what that influence is going to be, and we don't know how that's going to change the modeling uncertainty in the next couple of years as well.
You know, I think Commissioner's bottom line is it's an iterative process, and Coastal Fisheries has a phenomenal long-term data set, which they will continue to monitor the impact of these regulations, whatever it is you choose to do tomorrow, and we'll bring that back to you and can show you trends and are we meeting the proposed rate of recovery under whatever regime is ultimately set. Probably would take a couple of years. Also need to factor in the possibility of hurricanes and what impact that will have on certain sectors of the flounder stocks as well.
Well, that was my question, is absent some extraordinary event, we'll know if we need to take emergency action. So given that, I join Dan's thought on trying to accommodate the 2-day
on the
for
two
Rod
and Hale. 2-day.
Right. I don't hear anything compelling that would suggest that emergency action is required now on this. We have to be extremely restrictive, but you know, I fall in favor of opportunity.
You say, but are we saying 5 or 2?
I'm just saying that, at least in my mind, I got to consider 5. I don't know if there's actually a lot of difference. Again, I'm not the scientist I'm looking at. I'm talking about between the 5 and 2, excuse me, not the 5 and none, and closing. I understand that difference.
I'd like simplicity. 5 and 5 is consistent.
Then you stay with the same number all the way across.
But I also would make the point that we need to keep a close eye on this. And in a couple of years,
we have a sense
of where we are, and if we have to adjust, we adjust. But I'm with you that there's not a significant difference, at least here in the model, between 5 and 2.
Are you okay with that?
Well, I'm okay with whatever y'all choose to do.
Well, that was a very, very
politically correct answer.
Does it cause concern?
Well, certainly within the context, I mean, obviously these are difficult decisions. We've got a resource that we've taken some management actions on through the years. We haven't seen the desired result in that trend coming back upwards. You know, two fish is more conservative, five fish is a little more liberal and simpler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a trade-off of you know, those different...
But you're essentially really dropping from 10 to
correct.
Five
you're,
or 2.
You're certainly nine. Going from... I mean, yeah. You're,
I mean, remember, we're changing the whole dynamic
that's
of
right.
the whole year.
And then November, it's only the hook and line, right?
I mean, yeah, you'd get no gigging. I mean, certainly I wouldn't... I'd have a problem voting for gigging, but... Yeah, I'm trying to make sure we just put it in context, Robin. I'm
sure.
not trying
no.
to disagree with you.
No.
I just remember what we're talking about is a change of going from 10 to 5. I'm talking about and then from 60 to 30 for the 11 months. I mean, let's say you close November.
Yes.
So you're making a pretty dramatic change in the full 12-month cycle.
Yes. Well, a 35% reduction in the overall numbers
yes.
is what we would project here that would be landed. So, you know, and certainly somewhere in that neighborhood of a 70 to 80% gain in spawning biomass after 6 years.
We're not talking about a lot of people, though, if we go to 5 to 2. If you go to that chart.
The efficiency issue.
That's right. I mean, that shows that only, I mean, less than a few percent are catching more than 2 on rod and reel.
I don't know. The only thing I thought about was the simplicity issue. Really.
Yeah, and you're right.
You're staying consistent throughout the 12 months for law enforcement and all the other issues that go with anything you change.
So you're absolutely right.
That was all my thought process on that. Looking at the difference between 2 and 5, it's 8 points. It's less than 8.8%.
So in the absence of other comments about this, I guess we would, you know, my feeling is we'd stick with 5. November
for rod and
for a hook and
line.
I agree with that.
And the current proposal to reflect that.
Okay.
But
can you?
Do people want to?
The 5 and 30 for the entire year, except November, or that would include November also?
No commercial stops.
Yeah, right. Commercial would stop.
Well, why don't you walk through the recommendation
in November.
We've got to get clarity.
Yeah.
Robin, why don't you walk through the recommendation as you have been out visiting with the public about, and then talk about how you perceive our amendment so that we can make sure everybody's got clarity here. Remember, we don't vote on this till tomorrow, so
correct.
People can
correct.
Think about it. Robin, you'd be available if anybody had questions after this meeting or whatever.
Sure. Sure. Obviously, what we have proposed is 5 fish and 30 fish wreck and commercial, and a November closure to everyone. As I understand your amendment, you would be amending that to allow 5 fish rod and reel only in the month of November, close to all gigging in the month of November, both commercial and recreational gigging.
Correct.
And as Chairman Holt just indicated, you know, I'm sure you're going to hear a lot on this tomorrow, so you know you may have a different viewpoint, but you know we will be prepared to you know answer any questions in the interim, answer any of your questions, and do our best to you know have that amendment ready for you if you need it. I mean, you'll make the amendment, and then we'll put it in place in the register.
Is that everyone's understanding? Good with that?
Yes.
Good.
Thanks, Robin.
I want to quite just to make sure there's clarity for everybody. How is most commercial fishing done?
Certainly, most commercial fishing is done by gigging.
Okay, I just want to make sure everybody understood that. So, okay.
Right. Thank you.
Robin, thank you.
Yep. Clayton. Clayton.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for the record, I'm Clayton Wolf. I'm the director of the Big Game Program. This morning, I'm going to wrap up our proposals for our statewide hunting and fishing proclamation with the Wildlife Division proposals. Most of these are deer-related, most white-tailed deer, one mule deer, but we do have a proposed change for lesser prairie chickens. You may recall in January, Clay Brewer gave a presentation
and indicated that lesser prairie chickens are on the decline not only in Texas but throughout their range. In fact, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has moved the classification of prairie chickens on their candidate list from a level 8 to a level 2. So there's quite a bit of concern. Now, we do want to say that hunting, particularly in Texas, is not a factor contributing to this decline. But nonetheless, our staff and also our Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee suggests that a prudent measure is a suspension of the prairie chicken season until that population can recover. And so that's a proposal that was taken out to public hearings. And, of course, as Robin indicated, we had 47 public hearings statewide in addition to our web comments. Everything I show you will be a combination of letters, phone correspondence, and web correspondence. But relative to our proposal to temporarily suspend the prairie chicken season, we had 238 individuals comment, and 95% of those agreed with this proposal. On to deer.
Can I stop you there?
Yes.
Clayton? You know, we're going to temporarily suspend this season. I don't think anybody, Mark, I assume you're agreement with that.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to ask the question the right way relative to the changes going on in the habitat and everything else. Is there much hope to this lesser prairie chicken come back?
Well, I'm not a prairie chicken expert.
No,
I have visited a little bit.
What you've heard and
but I did visit with.
I haven't got a chance to talk about biology. Sure.
I did visit with Heather Whitlaw yesterday.
Yeah, expert,
and I did, and there are some populations that seem to be indicating some improvement because of some habitat modifications along in those particular areas. And so, yes, it can happen. There are farm bill programs out there that also provide some incentives. It seems like there is a bottleneck on delivery of those farm bill programs, you know, having enough folks to get out there that know where the chickens are, to visit with landowners, and then walk them through that process, which can be somewhat cumbersome for some of these farm bill programs. But the short of it is, if that could happen and if that delivery can occur on that land where it does occur, prairie chickens can respond.
Okay.
The other thing, of course, and Heather is working diligently on, is we obviously have to, if they're going to establish what a recoverable number is, we have to know how many there are out there and have a baseline. And so she's been working diligently looking at funding sources to establish some surveys out there so we can establish a baseline, and then it would be from that point that those technical experts would be able to decide what we would consider recovered. So we just don't know that answer right now.
Gotcha. One comment on that. I think one of the best things that the prairie chicken has working for it right now is the decrease in oil and natural gas prices, because the drilling industry is impacting their populations, at least in the two areas in Texas where we have significant numbers. They're more impacted by the drilling industry than any other aspect, and so laying down these rigs is slowing down the encroachment of their habitat.
What about your windmills, your turbines, power turbines, and that kind of stuff?
We're kind of on a threshold there to make a determination on what those structures, what the impact they will have. It's not a bird strike issue with
when they bird strike,
and it's more of a tall structure and how it impacts their ability to breed in these tall
they
structures.
Don't like them.
And I learned yesterday, you know, up to a couple of miles there can be an avoidance for those,
yeah,
those vertical structures. So
displacement.
It's a displacement issue, and I don't like those windmills. They're permanent. You know, a rig moves in and out, and I understand the issues it creates, but it's gone.
Right. Yeah. And, yeah, the habitat destruction is different with the whole gas rig.
Now they're extremely sensitive.
Okay, I'll carry on then.
We got out of your field of expertise there.
Yeah, I'm a bit uncomfortable right there, Chairman. I had Gene Miller in the back, and he was my escape route. He was ready to come forward. On to deer, something I am a little bit more comfortable with. You've seen these slides several times, so I'm not going to try to belabor too much. The slide before you depicts the current bag limits in Texas, anywhere from $1 to $3. And of course, we have proposals. This is the suite of proposals I'm presenting to you is an extensive review of all deer regulations in Texas, and we're looking at a 3-year cycle. So if you'll focus your attention first on the eastern rolling plains there just south of the panhandle, We have nine counties there in gray that we're proposing to go to a two-buck bag limit. That's kind of Shackelford, Throckmorton, and Baylor, Knox, on up to Wilbarger County there. And then if I'll back up again and show you the current state of affairs there in the eastern part of the state, you'll notice we have three different bag limit packages from 1 to 2 bucks or antler restrictions. And as I move forward here to our proposal, what we have proposed is basically antler restrictions for the eastern portion of the state. As far as public comments on this, we divided our buck bag limits into two different categories. We received 366 comments on the increase in the buck bag limit there in the eastern rolling plains. 366 individuals commented, 87% support for that proposal. In the antler restriction package, we received 635 comments with about 2 out of 3 individuals supporting this. Now, this is the lowest approval rating of all of our packages we have out there. So it probably is worth noting just some of the rationale, because we do receive a lot of comments. There are many individuals that oppose this regulation, particularly in the eastern part of the state, that they do not think a deer can grow a 13-inch spread, in fact, or at least that most of them cannot. And our data would indicate exactly the opposite. If we use our 6 original counties as the benchmark, and we see what happened there, and then we use our data, our statewide data, and look at these other populations, all those other populations have at least the capacity for deer to grow as big as those 6 counties. And in some cases, such as in the Cross Timbers, they actually grow larger. So surely, definitely our data would indicate that your average deer or the bulk of the population can grow a 13-inch spread, and that would protect it to the older age classes. Obviously, there are always exceptions, and it seems that some of those comments we get from folks, they seem to feel like for those few bucks that do not have the ability to grow a 13-inch spread, that somehow those animals are going to dominate breeding, and there's no study that would indicate that would occur. And then just some of the other comments we get, we did receive quite a few comments. Folks felt like the agent should be not in the business of promoting trophy hunting. And obviously our proposal is about balancing the age structure. Obviously when you have older bucks in a balanced herd, they do have larger antlers. But overall, still we have support of this package here. And I just do want to remind you that during several years back, we did a random survey of landowners and hunters, and on the average, 80% plus when we did a random survey of folks and asked them about the antler restriction package. As far as antlerless bag limits are concerned, our bag limits in Texas vary from 2 to 5. Obviously, if you choose to shoot 5 antlerless deer, you don't have any buck tags left. But that is the most liberal bag limit, and we currently have that in South Texas and the Edwards Plateau. We do have a burgeoning deer population in the eastern panhandle, and we are looking to provide more opportunity for landowners to control those deer numbers. And so we're proposing an increase in the bag limit there in the eastern panhandle. As you move further into the Cross Timbers, it's more of an opportunity issue, providing some opportunity. Staff feel like the deer populations there can support a 5 antlerless bag limit. Because we segregated this into several regions of the state when we took a comment, but if you'll see there, we basically received anywhere from 250 to 360 comments, anywhere from 84 to 91% approval to increase the bag limits in these different areas of Texas. Of course, we also use what we refer to as doe days, particularly in the eastern part of the state where track size is smaller and hunting pressure can be higher. That's the number of days in the season when someone can take an antlerless deer without an antlerless deer permit. The slide that I will transition to shows what we have proposed in the Texas Register, and in all cases except one county, that's an increase in the number of doe days. So there's what we have proposed. I'll back up one more time. This is current, and then this is proposed. The one change I'll indicate to you as I show the public comment here, if you look there up on the Red River,
That county that shows 74% approval, that's Grayson County, and I just want to remind you that we are proposing to maintain the archery-only season in Grayson County, but in order to remain consistent with the RMU for antlerless deer regs, we have proposed to go from 4 doe days to antlerless by permit only. So that's the one case where it was different. And then, of course, if you'll look at the different parts of the Piney Woods and the Post Oak Savannah, you can see our approval rating was anywhere from 83% to 92% in approval of increasing the number of doe days. We have proposed to open a whitetail deer season in Dawson, Desmith, and Martin counties. Actually, this some landowners approached our staff last year when we were scoping and proposing our mule deer seasons out there, and that kind of put the thought in their head, and they came forward with that proposal. You can see that web comments and our public hearing comments combined, 95% agree. I think it's only fair to the folks there in La Mesa that showed up at the public hearing. I believe we had about 7 people that spoke there, and all of those local individuals were opposed to opening a deer season. There's just concern of over-exploitation. However, and they also recommended other measures that might be more conservative. But our staff is comfortable with the proposal we have there, simply based upon the fact that landowners and the landowners out there, you know, have the ability to control that and control access. And so our staff still supports that proposal. And overall, when you combine web comments and public hearings together, 95% of those individuals support that as well. Dallam, Hartley, Moore, Oldham, Potter, and Sherman counties currently are the only 6 counties in the state that have a 16-day whitetail deer season, and that overlaps our mule deer season up in the panhandle. And so the combinations of the proposals I showed before you would result in a 1-buck-2 antlerless, but we also are proposing the full 2-month season along with the rest of the state. As far as comments on that, we received 252 comments. 95% of those people were in agreement with extending the deer season. We have late antlerless and spike seasons in Texas by use of modern firearms and also muzzle loaders. The late antlerless and spike seasons are typically in those places where we see the need for increased harvest. You'll recall we have proposed to increase the bag limit throughout much of Texas. And so for the antlerless and spike season there in the middle of the state, we're proposing to take that up through the eastern panhandle and over to just west of Dallas-Fort Worth as well. I'll back up again. If you'll look in the eastern part of the state, the southern Piney Woods currently has a muzzleloader season, and we have proposed, to take that into the northern Piney Woods as well as the oak prairies, marshes, and southern post-oak savannah. You remember probably back in January that I indicated that the start of these two types of seasons are a little bit different. The antlerless and spike season begins on the Monday after the close of general season, whereas the muzzleloader season starts on the following Saturday. So we have proposed that both these seasons start on the Monday following the close of the general season and run for 14 consecutive days. Additionally, we propose no changes to the bag limit for the modern firearm season, but we are proposing the county bag limits that are in place during the regular season also apply during the during the muzzleloader season. 87% of the 358 folks that responded agree with our proposal to increase the antlerless or to extend the antlerless and spike season up into North Texas. And 88% of the 360 people that spoke to the muzzleloader season agreed with our proposal to extend the muzzleloader season as well as change the bag limit. On Forest Service land, Corps of Engineer land, and River Authority land in Texas, many times there can be unlimited access, but hunting can be allowed. So we have special provisions in our regulations to control antlerless deer harvest. That is somewhat of a hodgepodge, and we are proposing to standardize and consolidate some of that language. And so we have proposed that the standard language be antlerless by permit only, unless otherwise specified. And we do have a couple of exceptions we have proposed. One of those is for Fannin County, where we where we would propose no analyst permit be required on Forest Service land because other control mechanisms are in place on those Forest Service tracts. And for Wise and Montague counties, we are proposing doe days for those four days at Thanksgiving, and that would be consistent with the county. 89% of the people that spoke to this proposal were in favor of it. There were 314 comments as of yesterday afternoon. We were approached late in the regulation cycle last year to include Palmer County in our mule deer proposal. It was a little bit late to fully scope and vet that, so we put that in this cycle. Palmer County is there on the New Mexico County line, and we have proposed a buck-only season in Palmer County. 90% of the comments are in favor of the mule deer season in Palmer County. The slide before you depicts this past hunting season. The green is our regular season dates for most of Texas, not counting South Texas. And where our and in red is where our youth-only deer seasons fall. We have proposed in the Texas Register that the late youth-only deer season start the Monday following the close of the general season and run for 14 consecutive days. 507 people commented on this particular proposal, 80% in agreement. Our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, ever since October of 2007, has been taking on the challenge of wrestling with issues relating to waste of game violations, deer tagging. There's quite a complex array of statutes and regulations, and we do know legislation has been filed at the Capitol. In fact, there were hearings at the Senate Natural Resources Committee meeting last week, and the committee substitutes that we saw actually would incorporate some of these recommendations of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. So things are rolling downtown, and David and Sinclair and I gave testimony on that, as well as Greg Simons, who is a member of our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, went down there and spoke in favor of the bill. So some of these discussions are taking place downtown, and it looks like things are rolling forward. However, as far as tagging requirements are concerned, this commission has the authority to modify tagging requirements. And so the current state of affairs for tagging requirements indicates that tagging requirements cease when a carcass is at final destination, it's been processed for cooking or storage, and is beyond quarters. And you may recall that issue of beyond quarters is a technical issue, not necessarily in reality, but you could have a deer in your freezer and still be required to have a tag on it. So we proposed in the Texas Register that those tagging requirements would cease when at least one quarter has been removed, and that deer or the venison has been prepared for cooking or storage. Now, here recently, what we did discover is there's a difference of opinion in our proposal and what we thought the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee agreed upon and what is in the Texas Register right now. There were some that thought that the tagging requirements applied only to tags and permits, and that other documentation, such as the requirement for a wildlife resource document or proof of sex documentation, did not cease. And then there was a subset of individuals that thought when we used the term tagging requirements, we were using that inclusive of WRD requirements and proof of sex requirements. The majority of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, I polled them, and they believed that's all inclusive and including WRDs, but there were enough other individuals and enough confusion that we are going to withdraw this proposal. We have time. We have a Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee meeting on the 14th. And so what we intend to do is propose in the Texas Register some language that gives the advisory committee and this commission the broadest latitude to make recommendations and decisions. What we will propose is that wildlife resource document and proof of sex requirements cease when tagging requirements cease. And in addition, I just want to be clear that we will also discuss at what point that ceases, whether that's one quarter or four quarters. And we'll get some advice from Ann Bright and our legal folks on what language gives us the most latitude. But we do propose to put this in the Texas Register, then go to the advisory committee and come back to you in May for adoption, and that will still give us time to get the right information in our outdoor annual. And finally, there are some non-substantive changes. Last year, this commission went through some rulemaking on turkey regs. There's a little reorganization and some paragraphs were renumbered, but there's still some incorrect references in there, and so there's just a little bit of housekeeping to clean some of that up. And with that, I conclude my presentation, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Mr. Chairman? I have two questions. One on, with the extended season that you now proposed in the six counties in the Panhandle, does that make the white-tailed deer season uniform statewide?
Yes, sir. It does. It, with every area except South Texas.
And then in Grayson County, regardless of doe days, any of the seasons, it's all antler, I mean all archery only.
It's archery only. Yes, sir.
What changes, if any, are you proposing to Grayson County from the last meeting?
From the last meeting, when we left here, no changes. Our proposal for Grayson County is antler restrictions, which would be a 2-buck bag limit. They are currently a 1-buck bag limit. And then we also recommended and went to the Texas Register with changing it from 4 doe days to antlerless by permit only. That's what we presented in January, and we've gotten support for it. I mean, 74%, I believe, of the folks supported the change in doe days to antlerless by permit only.
Questions?
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And I think we have completed our business. Mr. Jackson.
Thank you very much. Before we move to conservation, I wanted to recognize some people. I understand Dr. Doug Slack. Dr. Slack, are you here? Can you stand up? I understand you have a class here today and tomorrow. You can make class tomorrow? Different group? Are they, and can you explain a little bit what your group is, what their students are studying?
It's a wildlife conservation course for students in our department. So they're studying policy making. They've been thinking about you.
Well, I assume we're probably boring them stiff, to be honest with you. But.
They've got to learn where the sausage is really made.
Yeah, and it's as ugly as sausage is, I can tell you that. Could the students stand up? And let's give them a big round of applause. I'm glad you all are getting involved. Yeah. Thank you for being here. And Dr. Slack, thank you. I appreciate your interest, and certainly anything we can do for you, don't hesitate to call on us. Thank you very much.